This episode, Once Upon a Comic Book Adaptation, Battlestar Galactica. Hello, and welcome to the Once Upon a Geek podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On today's episode, we are finding our joy by talking about comic book adaptations of movies and television shows, specifically the adaptation of the original Battlestar Galactica. Now, my name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I am your host, but I'm not doing this alone. For this episode, I am joined by an old friend who I don't get enough opportunities to chat with. He's a comic guy, he's a movie guy, and he's an awesome guy. Folks, please help me welcome to the show Mr. Paul Spataro. How you doing, Paul? Thanks for being here.
I'm doing good. It's almost sad that this is just an audio medium, because then I couldn't do my fake look behind me as if somebody else is here when you're talking that way.
Well, I was going to write an intro that was all mean and snarky, but I can't. It's you. There's nothing to be snark about. I couldn't do it.
Give it time.
Now, folks, thank you so much for tuning in for the Once Upon a Geek podcast. However, if this is your first stop on your Battlestar Galactica journey, I got to tell you, turn around. You missed the left turn. Paul, tell them where they should be first.
Well, first, you should be on last week's episode of Is It Yours, where Shag and I talked about the Battlestar Galactica 1978 TV movie / big screen movie pilot for the TV series.
So, yeah, we had a great time talking about that. Again, you can find that out there on the Two True Freaks Network as part of the Is It Jaws show. And that's where the focus of our discussion about the movie and Battlestar Galactica and stuff itself. So today on this show, instead, we're going to be focused more on the comic. We're going to be talking a little bit about the reboot as well and about other comic book adaptations and our passions for those. So that's what you're going to get in this episode, and I'm excited about it. And by the way, I should mention also, I'm sort of continuing my trend this month of being, I guess I could call it Treasury Comic Curious. I don't know. I appeared this month already on an episode of Treasury Cast with Rob Kelly discussing some Star Wars Treasury comics. So this time out, we'll be talking about Battlestar Galactica that had a Treasury comic.
You do stuff with Rob Kelly?
I've been known to once or twice in my time.
I wasn't sure. Now that he got married, I wasn't sure if he was doing this anymore.
Oh, well, Kelly's a much better, pretty much everything than me, without a doubt. You know, she's phenomenal. She's absolutely their better half. And if I could podcast with her instead of Rob, I would.
I can understand.
She doesn't read as many Battlestar Galactica comic books. So there you go. All right. I have a question for you, because we covered on your show our own personal history of the Battlestar Galactica TV show or the movie, right? But now let's flip it to comics. What is your personal history with Battlestar Galactica comics? Did you ever read any growing up at any point, or is this your first exposure?
This is my first exposure. This is totally a blind spot for me. I never read any of the comics. I've seen them. I've kind of just turned my nose up at them. And it's weird because, like I said on our earlier broadcast, I enjoyed the pilot when I had seen it on TV. And yet I never followed up to watch the actual series when it was on, which is just a very strange thing when I look back on it. And I don't understand why I didn't. But the same held true for the comics, because I was not watching the series at all. I really didn't have any interest in the comics. And it just makes no sense, because this is the type of thing that's, you know, right in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm kind of shocked, because when I start telling you a little bit about this, I think you're going to regret it. Because let's just start by saying they published 23 issues. First few issues are representing the TV show, but then they go into original stories. Now, the people involved with these books, man, we're talking about Rich Buckler, Sal Buscema, Pat Broderick, and more importantly, Walt Simonson. Walt Simonson drew about half of the issues in this series, and even wrote some of them. So there's an incredible pedigree with these comics of incredible creators. So I think I would say it's worth your time to seek them out, if nothing else, just to see some of this amazing artwork.
And yeah, hearing that rundown of creators, that's almost enough to just make me run out and get them, and then top it off with the fact that I'm pretty sure I've seen this like in the dollar bins.
Well, I wonder nowadays, right? You know, since the reimagining, I wonder if they're still out there, because that's how I got most of my collection, was through the 50 cent bins and things like that. Again, there's only 23 issues. I bought a few of them off the stands. I very vividly remember buying issue number 23 from the convenience store. And it's funny cover. It's got Starbuck and Apollo, but behind them is like their teammate, a guy named Jolly. But in here, Simonson has drawn him huge, and he's got this giant like top knot ponytail, his head shaved, and he's got a giant ponytail. It's hilariously bizarre. But the thing that always cracked me up about the cover is, and you know how comics were in the 70s and 80s as far as first issue, last issue kind of thing, right? First issue, collector's item, last issue, go out with a whimper. Well, on the cover here, it says in big bold letters, last issue, a collector's item. And I'm like, what? you know, is that a joke? You know, it's like, I don't remember there ever being a last issue that's a collector's item. It's usually the other way around.
I guess the thought process being that if you're a fan of this show, this is it.
I guess
get
so.
It now while you can.
There you go. Get it while it's hot. If nothing else, again, it's worth it for the Walt Simonson art. Now, they've collected some of these. Titan, in fact, did it most recently. They collected a couple of them. I'm in my hands. I'm holding right here Volume 2. It's called The Memory Machine, but this collects several issues from that run. So you can see them in nice high glossy paper and all that kind of thing. Yeah, I'm looking at your beloved Sire Yuri right here, drawn by Sal Buscema. Ooh, so that's something to behold there. If you really want to deep dive on the other issues of Battlestar Galactic Comics, the best place is back on the True Freaks Network, where you heard Is It Jaws? Andy Leyland does a show called Palace of Glittering Delights, and he did a whole episode back in July 2019 all about Marvel's Galactica comics. It's episode 121. It is well worth your time. Andy did a great job, and I'm not just saying that because I sort of tricked him into doing it, but basically I said I wanted to do it. I didn't have the time and planted the seed in his head so that he would do it, which was great. Saved me the trouble. So I read some of those, and then other publishers picked up the ball and ran with it, like Maximum Press, which was a Rob Liefeld company, picked up the license to Battlestar Galactica around 1995 and did a couple series. Given anything associated with Rob Liefeld, there's things to love and there's things not to love. I picked up a few of those. I, at that point, 1995, I was desperate for anything Battlestar Galactica, so I was happy to have it, right? And then a company called Realm Press picked it up in 1998. I've never even heard of this company. I didn't even know they existed. This is just me getting stuff out of Wikipedia at this point. I had no idea that they were involved, but they published several things. Then in 2006, you know, after the reimagining starts, Dynamite Entertainment picks up the license. They started by doing a lot of reimagining stories, you know, the later, the 2004 series forward with that cast doing that. But then they started dipping in doing some classic stuff. And a lot of those were written by Dan Abnett, who is absolutely phenomenal. If you are you familiar with Dan Abnett at all?
Yeah, I've read some of his, wasn't he kind of one of the chief guys when they recreated Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yes, he was. He was very involved in that. And he's done all kinds of stuff. He's also a novelist. Like, I've read some of his books, and he's an expert writer. So having, you know, the Battlestar Galactica cast under his direction is fine with me. So very happy to have him do that. I got a couple of those trades. They actually, I think the last thing that Dynamite published, and this wasn't an Abnett story, but around 2018, they actually did BSG versus BSG with a classic team crew and the reimagining crew actually meet. There's like some cross-dimensional multiversal thing. The two crews meet, so you get the two Adamas together. You get a fun scene of Tom Zirik, played by Richard Hatch, face-to-face with the original Apollo, played by Richard Hatch, which immediately makes them think that that's a Cylon, because they're duplicates of them. And there's some fun story points in there. And they're actually dealing with the Cylon reptilian alien race. And is it great? No. But it was enjoyable. So anyway, I've read some of the Dynamite output, and I enjoy it quite a bit. Now, Paul, I want to talk about the Reimagined series. I really do. But I think before we do that, let's take a second, because I think that conversation is going to go deeper than I imagine. Why don't we take a second to thank our sponsors, and then we'll wrap that right into the reboot.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, folks, this episode of Once Upon a Geek is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for comic trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode, we pick a comic collected edition to discuss from the InStock Trades library that, you know, ties into the story or the discussion in some way, shape, or form. I picked Battlestar Galactica Trade Paperback Volume 1 Memorial. And this is from the Dynamite Entertainment era, but it's about the classic BSG folks. So we're talking the original crew from the 70s, telling a more modern tale. It's by Andy Lanning and Dan Abnett. There's that name again. With art by Cesar Razick, with cover by Alex Ross. It's 128 pages. It collects the first few issues of that run again, the original cast telling an all new story, celebrating at that point. It was the 35th anniversary when they did this. Fun stuff. Again, really great creators working on favorite characters. But what's not to love, right? The Battlestar Galactica, as you'll hear us discuss, I think the Battlestar Galactica characters really lend themselves to the comic book format anyway. So there's a lot of trade paperbacks from Battlestar Galactica to choose from. I just picked this one mainly because of Dan Abnett, and I love his work and the classic folks. But you can normally pay $19.99 for this, but on InStock Trades right now, it's 50% off, so it only costs you $9.99. That's dirt cheap. So it is well worth checking that out. Now, Paul, not mandatory, but did you happen to bring an InStock Trades recommendation?
I did. I looked and I said, you know, what would I be interested in reading based on what we're talking about? And as we're going to get into the reboot, you know, that was really my sweet spot for Battlestar Galactica. And I saw that they actually have a season zero. Mm-hmm. It's the new Battlestar Galactica season zero trade paperback, volume one with a photo cover. And it's set 2 years before the reboot series starts. And it's a six-issue six-issue miniseries, and it's all collected in this trade paperback. It's written and drawn by people who I'm not familiar with, so I cannot speak to the quality. It's Brandon Jerwa wrote it. Steven Segovia and Jackson Herbert are the artists. It's 168 pages long. It is a $19.99 cover price, and it's 30% off at $13.99. And it's also from the Dynamite era.
Heck of a deal right there. And the Season Zero, I've read some of that stuff, and it was fun, interesting reads because they get to explore the corners of what it was like with the Cylons running around without the Colonials necessarily knowing they were there.
And it probably also gives you a chance to meet these characters before they're in the maximum stress zone that they are pretty much as soon as the miniseries of the reboot starts.
Oh, yes, it does. Every single week. No doubt about that. Folks, for these and all your other comic book trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we need some help with the expenses. And we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. And we appreciate that. So if you're enjoying shows on the network, just like this one, the best way to support our shows is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast, and consider supporting the Firewater Podcast Network. And at certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your show of choice. And in this case, we'd like to say special thanks to David A. Gutierrez and Gord Tolden. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. All right, folks, this is the part of the show where you're going to get involved, because as I always say, this is not just about my opinion, my guest's opinion. It's about all of us. We are a geeky community, and we're in this together. I want to hear your thoughts and your opinions on comic book adaptations, on Battlestar Galactica, on the reimagining. Fair warning, Paul and I both love it, so don't come at it with your hate goggles on. or any favorite, you know, comic adaptations, anything like that, any Galactica memories that you love. The best way to be a part of the conversation is to leave a comment on our website. So just visit it, fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. Leave your thoughts on the show post there. You can also find us on Twitter as Once Upon a Geek, or on Facebook and Instagram as Once Upon a Geek Podcast. And remember, comments that are left on our website will get read on the show. So we do feedback every fifth episode of Once Upon a Geek. In case you haven't been keeping track, this is episode number 10. So a little bit later, when Paul and I are done chatting, I'm going to do your feedback from the last five episodes. So if you leave your feedback on this episode, you'll hear it in five episodes from now.
And I wanted to comment on that a little bit, though, just to throw it out to you. Because my theory is, I never mind disagreeing with people, and I never discount anybody else's opinion if they are willing to express it intelligently. My point being, if you and I love the reboot and somebody else thinks it's the worst thing ever on TV, I'm willing to discuss it with them. I'm willing to go through an intelligent conversation with them. What I don't want to hear is, well, why didn't you like it? Well, because it sucked. You know, just give me an intelligent reason. I didn't like it because it was slow moving. I thought the acting was this. I thought the story was derivative of this. Something like that, I'm fine with. And I'm never going to say, well, you're wrong, because what you like is very, very subjective. So I don't have a problem with it. Just, you know, don't hate on other people for liking things that you don't.
I'm absolutely in your corner. And I just like to tease the folks at home. I think they know by now that I love intelligent discourse where someone doesn't agree with me and they want to have a different opinion on it. As long as, like you said, it's respectful of the discussion. That's awesome. I'm totally there for it. But in order to maintain my reputation, I just have to tell them they're stupid and wrong. So that's how that works. It's a balance. It's a balancing act.
Yeah, there you go. That's fair. So, you know, it's funny when the 2004 reboot came, I really wanted to see it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was geared up for it. And like three times I watched the pilot, and then I started to watch the first couple of episodes, and it was a little slow moving and it was a little dry, which is funny because one of the first episodes is called Water. And I had a tough time like really getting a foothold in it to watch it. And then two summers ago, and I was telling Shag this story before, but two summers ago, I had broken my foot and I was laid up. I had to sit with my foot elevated for weeks. And my father-in-law, you know, this was during the summer. My father-in-law did not have air conditioning at the time. And he was coming over to the house fairly regularly, and he would sit with me and keep me company. And we ended up starting to watch the series, and we were watching it an episode or two every time he came over. And we would have these deep discussions about the morality of what they were doing, or the political effectiveness of what they were doing, or the catch 22 choices that they had to make, you know, that no matter what you did, people were going to die. And it became so much more layered to me than it had been, that now this is one of my favorite shows, having watched it that way. And then, you know, we talked about nostalgia a little bit when we talked about the 78 show. Not long after that, my father-in-law passed away. So I considered this was kind of like a gift from the gods that they gave me this time where I got to sit with him hour after hour after hour before we lost him and have these discussions. So I'm never going to be objective about whether I like that series or not. It's always going to have a special place for me.
That's incredible. Just to have that opportunity to share something like that. Because I mean, we all have different intersections in our lives, right? With family members, especially, you know, extended family, like father-in-laws, mother-in-laws. It's a little difficult to find a connection sometimes, but to have something like that where you sit down for appointment television or, you know, maybe it's streaming, whatever, but you watch it and you're able to have a conversation about the deep, like you said, the political thoughts, the ramifications, the choices. I mean, that's, wow, what a great opportunity to have that. And what a wonderful memory. I'm almost embarrassed to share my stories because it doesn't even rate compared to yours. But I'm so glad you had that opportunity, Paul. That's really wonderful.
Thank you.
So in my case, it's more just I watched it because it was on, right? You know, I was a huge Battlestar Galactica fan as I went on and on and on in Paul's show. And I wouldn't shut up, by the way. Fair warning if you haven't listened yet. I would not shut up about how much I love the classic series. So when the reboot came, I was a little nervous. Like, I wanted a continuation. I didn't want a reboot. And then I watched it. And other than the fact that they didn't use Stu Phillips' original theme, I loved every minute of it. I absolutely fell in love with it. By the end of the miniseries, I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I didn't realize they could do this level of quality and depth and drama on television. ER was very dramatic, and maybe I shouldn't be comparing the two, but it's like, this is drama and tension stacked on top of so much more and intrigue, and wow, it was powerful. And week to week, like I still say, after the miniseries, that first episode, it's called 33, where basically the Cylons are chasing the Galactica and they show up every 33 minutes. That episode is some of the best television ever put together. It's intense. It is so stressful. It's compelling. It's everything. I've watched that episode several times and it is incredible, incredible television.
I totally agree. And it's amazing that it was too dry for me the first couple of times I tried it.
Well, did you get past the miniseries the first couple of times or did you not?
Yeah, I got past the miniseries.
Okay.
And then when I started to watch the regular series, it would lose me. Until when I finally, you know, I can't quite say we binged it, but we came very close to binging it. And I think that intensity of watching episodes at such a short, you know, interval really added to the intensity of the show.
It's an exhausting show emotionally because every episode there's an enormous crisis, life-threatening to the fleet, where, you know, the whole human race might be wiped out because they don't, like you said, they don't have enough water or they don't have enough air or there's a bomb or whatever it might be. It can really emotionally, it's a lot to take in. Like binging it, I actually would imagine it'd be hard to binge. So it's interesting that you guys enjoyed it more that way. Cause like, I don't know, I'd want to curl up in a ball and cry after a while, but like, I can't take anymore. Cause I would say the first two seasons are amazing. They're some of the best, again, television sci-fi television ever. I think it's that great. The third season, I actually, like a lot of people, I don't know why it happened. It wasn't intentional. I kind of fell out during the third season, right around the boxing episode. Again, it wasn't nothing intentional. It just kind of life got in the way, I guess. I don't know.
I think if I remember correctly, when it first came out, I think there was like a long break during that season. And I could see where that could just kill your momentum.
That may have been what it was. Because, I mean, there was basically the beginning of the third season, they're on, I guess it's called New Caprica or whatever. And it's a hellhole, basically. It's a horrible planet that they settled on and all these things go wrong. And then they finally get back off the planet. And that's where I guess I just drifted off for a while. Now, I came back during the last season and watched a whole bunch of that. And I own the whole thing on Blu-ray. And I love it to death. But one thing I got to talk about with the reboot series is there's a board game. And when normally when someone mentions a board game based on a TV show, you kind of roll your eyes and be like, okay, yeah, I played the ET board game. Thanks. No, I'm fine. This is not like playing Monopoly. This is an incredibly intensive board game. It takes like 5 or 6 hours to play it. This is not something you just do like on the drop of a hat. Let's play it. You plan an afternoon for this. And the way, and I'm not going to get into the details of it, but it is the most accurate capturing of the spirit of a TV show I've ever seen in a game. Like literally every round, you flip over a crisis card and something has gone horribly wrong in the fleet. Again, it's, you know, the water tanks are gone or the food's gone or there's a riot or there's a prison break, you know, whatever it might be. But it also just reinforces how terrible their lives were and how much crap happens to them. And the game is completely encompassing. You find out that, like, you'll say you got six players around the table. Someone around the table is a Cylon and they don't even know it until towards the end of the game. And then they're actually working to sabotage everyone from within, and you don't know who is doing it. I mean, it captures the spirit of the show so well. If you ever have the chance to play the Battlestar Galactica board game, oh my gosh, do it. So I won't say any more because I could talk forever about it.
Well, the sad thing is, unless I come down to Florida and hang out with you, I don't know if anybody will play with me.
I don't even own it. I have to play it with friends who own it. So one of the things you talked about on Is It Jaws that you wanted to talk about was some of the casting for the reboot. And again, we're going to get into the comic adaptation of the original Battlestar Galactica. I promise we are in just a minute. But the reboot is something we both are passionate about.
I think the casting choices they made are amazing.
Yeah.
So potentially damaging that they were really, you know, they really took chances and they really had, you know, I'm just, you know, thinking obviously Starbuck, but even Ty and Boomer.
Yep.
Just the choices they made, the backlash they could have faced from the fans of the original series was huge. And I think it was really gutsy of them. And I think it all worked out well. I think, you know, even just the tone of the show, everything, like all the choices they made were risky.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about the casting. Adama's casting also. I mean, you know, not very Lorne Greene-like.
Oh, interesting. See, I thought that was the most in-spirit casting. Because, I mean, Lorne Greene comes to Battlestar, as you mentioned on Is It Jaws, you know, as sort of a father figure, right? He was he carried a level of authority with him into the role that people just accepted. And for me, Edwards James Olmos had that same level of authority from Stand and Deliver, from Miami Vice. You know, he was the boss. He wasn't the father. He was the boss. And he carried that in. So I felt like that was actually the most in-spirit casting. Like, I felt like that was similar to the Lorne Greene casting. Interesting.
See, I see it as different because for exactly what you said. He wasn't the father. He was the boss.
Okay.
And even on this show, he has a much more, you know, fractured relationship with Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that comes across. And, you know, eventually as the show progresses, they kind of heal those wounds and they bridge that gap. But to me, it was gutsy. I really think, I don't think, like I said, I don't think you look at Edward James Olmos and think Lorne Greene.
Okay. Obviously, the big ones, like you said, Starbuck was a massive risk. Boomer was to some extent. And you mentioned the flack they could have got. They did. I mean, I remember the fan outrage. I mean, it was nasty how people would come out against Katie Sackhoff. Oh, gosh, am I getting that right? I'm just talking off the top of my head. Okay. Yeah, the casting of her. And I think by the end of the first season, I think those people who had been detractors finally realized, oh, my gosh, she is Starbuck. She's phenomenal. This role she's playing is excellent. And thankfully, they came around. But I mean, it was a lot of big chances. It also changing the whole tone of it. I mean, there was a lot of very outspoken. I mean, Richard Hatch himself, the guy who played Apollo and later Zirik, he was extremely, and not everyone may remember this, but he was extremely outspoken against the new Battlestar Galactica. He was very opposed to it. At every convention I went to, I would see him talk about it. He was unhappy about it, expressed a lot of anger. And then suddenly he got invited to be on the show. And then
it was all okay.
And it was all okay. Exactly right. I got to think, and I don't mean to be, you know, talk trash, but I got to think that's part of the reason they, besides the fact he's a good actor, that's part of the reason they invited him on the show. Was like, all right, the face of the enemy, let's get him on our side.
You know, I'm just thinking, and see, I didn't have the love of the original series. And we talked about that again on Is It Jaws. We talked about how I watched it. I enjoyed it, but I just kind of walked away from it. So there wasn't the risk of me, you know, having problems with the casting. But in like one of the opening scenes of the pilot, when she's playing poker with Ty and she beats him and she just kind of does this little stand in your spot dance to rub in his face, she won me over that second because that she just seemed so cool.
So I struggled for like a hot second because like I love Dirk Benedict's portrayal of Starbuck. Like I love that character Starbuck. I like his portrayal of Starbuck so much. I followed it to Face Man on A-Team. You know, it's like I love the character he played. And so when it came here, I wasn't mad that they recast Starbuck as a woman. I just had trouble glomming onto her in that persona. But like I said, it lasted a hot second. I don't know. Maybe it was when she punched Ty or something. It's whatever it was.
Which is about 2 seconds after she does that little dance right.
Somewhere along there, I was like, okay, I'm in. Yep. All right. She's a little bit different than my Starbuck, but she's my new Starbuck. You know, so I definitely got on board with that.
Like I said, I have a deep affection for the reboot now. And, you know, a lot of it is based on the quality of the reboot, and a lot of it is based on now, you know, new nostalgia.
Yeah. Yeah. Understandable. I mean, you've got some great memories that you'll carry with you forever there. All right. Well, let's do what we promised here.
Oh, yeah. There's a comic.
Well, there's not just that. We're going to talk about other comic adaptations too. So folks, we're going to make you wait even longer to hear about Battlestar Galactica, because we're going to say about comic adaptations growing up. I mean, these were a huge part of our childhood, right? Like, what's your personal history with comic adaptations of either movies or TV? Any favorites? You know, let's talk a little bit, not too long, but let's talk a little bit about the magic of comic book adaptations. Any that you remember really well?
I have a very checkered past with comic book adaptations, because usually, you know, early on in my childhood, when I was reading them, they would be like the Charlton or Gold Key type adaptations. Okay. And they, you know, the dialogue and the art was all just very poor.
Okay, sure.
A lot of times they didn't have the character likenesses right, you know, even whether they had the rights to it or not. I wasn't very big on the adaptations. I mean, there are exceptions. You know, I really liked when they did, you know, the Further Adventures of Indiana Jones.
Sure.
Surprisingly, I never really got into the original Marvel Star Wars. I had bought a lot of the issues when they came out, but I was never like a big devotee of that.
Well, thanks for coming, Paul. Folks, come back next week on Once Upon a Geek. Oh, I'm sorry.
and it wasn't, you know, well, to be fair, a lot of it was early on, because they had their hands so tied as far what they were able to do with the characters, because Lucasfilm, you know, needed them to just kind of leave them where they are, you know, and so it didn't capture my imagination the way I wanted it to. I'm not saying they were bad stories. I'm just saying that there's something felt lacking as far as that went.
Let me steer you a little bit then, if I can. Let's distinguish between comic book continuations, which is like Further Adventures of Indiana Jones, or the later Star Wars comics after they got done recovering. Let's what about the adaptations themselves? The ones where, like, you know, like what we're going to cover here at Battlestar Galactica, where it tells you the story of something you saw on the screen. Any memories of any of those at any point?
Definitely have enjoyed a lot of those, especially the ones that were kind of in the era before I could get VHS tapes and all of that.
Exactly. You know, yeah.
On Back to the Bins, Scott Gardner and I did an episode by episode, you know, one book for each episode, or one issue for each episode of the run through Logan's Run.
I was with Scott when he pulled an issue of Logan's Run out of a dollar bin that had been signed by George Perez.
Oh, wow.
I was with him when he bought it. So I'm a big fan there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I love that adaptation. You know, I did enjoy very much the Planet of the Apes adaptations that came out. And, you know, that goes with my love of Planet of the Apes in general. So, I mean, there's definitely winners in there for me. We did an Is It Yours? Back to the Bins, you know, combo show, me and Scott Rifen, where we went over Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and the comic adaptation of it.
That was a lot of fun to listen to, by the way. Really enjoyed that.
Oh, thank you. It's for me, it's definitely hit and miss. That would be, I think, the way I would have to describe my experience with comic adaptations. There's some that I love, and then there's some that I didn't care for. And I often now in my twilight of life, I'm finding that I'm more fond of some of the adaptations than I used to be. And I'm going to give my favorite adaptation is the one that never really existed. One year for April Fool's Day, we did an episode of Back to the Bins where we covered Gold Key or whatever, but we did Gold Key adaptation of The Godfather, which never existed. That was our April Fool's joke. So that's my personal favorite.
That's fantastic. That's a great idea too. I mean, just to see Gold Key do that especially, that would be hysterical.
And Chris Honeywell, you know, mocked up a cover for us to put on the episode art.
That's amazing. That is absolutely amazing. It sounds like something Chris would do as well, without a doubt. So I love what you said about the VCRs, right? Because you're right. This was our way to relive the movies. There was no other way. You know, you might get the storybook, you know, or, you know, what do you call that? Viewmaster with the 3D right. slides or something. But the comic adaptations were a chance to relive the story. And, you know, sometimes there were like scenes, like in this too, like there's scenes in it that weren't in the movie because they were from an earlier draft that they worked from. It's almost like DVD extras sometimes in the comic adaptations, which I loved. Now, I'm a little bit younger than you because you're like, I don't know, ancient. And, you know,
I think I'm turning to dust as we're talking.
So for me, my era of adaptation is a little bit later. Like, for example, Battlestar Galactica. I owned the Treasury edition, or you call it tabloid edition, whichever you want to call it, but I call it Treasury. I own the Treasury edition of Battlestar Galactica. I read it over and over and over. And I swear there's still a copy in my garage somewhere, and I can't find the damn thing, and I'm frustrated, but I swear I still have it somewhere. I had that growing up. Star Wars, you know, I loved the Marvel Star Wars comics. So, you know, the Star Wars adaptations, those were, I remember buying those at a grocery store in a 3-pack, and then Empire Strikes Back adaptations, of course, from Return of the Jedi. And then it's interesting. I would go to the grocery store, the convenience store, and pick up all kinds of adaptations. And if, for some reason, I always seem to get number one, but rarely ever found number two. So like I have number one of For Your Eyes Only, the comic adaptation. Mm. And that's how I would re-experience that story, because I'd seen it in the film, and that's how I'd re-experience. Krall. I don't know why I was so excited about Krall. Remember, that's the one with the glaive, the five-bladed weapon that the guy would throw in the 80s, kind of a fantasy-based story. I was obsessed with that. I had that one as adaptation. Raiders of the Lost Ark. Really nice adaptation. Before the Further Adventures, they adapted Raiders of the Lost Ark. Marvel did a comics and the magazine, and I actually own both, and I would read both because I was just so, you know, everyone was enamored with Raiders, right?
Oh.
And then other ones like Dark Crystal and Last Starfighter, and one I bought when I got older, because I look back and love this film ridiculously now, is House 2, The Second Story. It's a terrible movie, but I love that movie so much. It's like one of my favorite B movies ever. It's just stupid, and I love the comic adaptation for it even more. But these were something that you don't see anymore. Now that people can, you know, you can stream the movies, you can watch them from home, you can go to the theater, you can buy them on DVD. Comic adaptations don't serve that purpose anymore. You don't get very many of them anymore. And so I feel like it's kind of a lost piece of our childhood that kids will never understand now.
Even in the 80s when VCRs became widespread, you had a gap between when it was in the movies and when it would come out on video.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't 2 months. It would be, you know, sometimes it would be an extended period of time, especially for Star Wars and Raiders. Those things were held back for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Disney was holding back a lot of movies, and then they would release them with the promise that, you know, 2 months from now, we're taking them off the shelves and you won't see them again because we're putting them back in the vault.
Right.
So comic adaptations, even, you know, as VCRs started to become popular, were still a big thing. But then, you know, now, you know, and I think it's really been, you know, kind of like pushed to the limit by the pandemic. But now, you know, you something's in the movies and you're saying, well, do I go to see this or do I wait 6 weeks until I can stream it?
Sometimes you can stream it the same day. You know? Sometimes. So it's you're right, because there was that window of release. But also back then, we couldn't afford VHS tapes. Remember? I mean, they were super expensive at first. So you had to get them from the video rental store. So you didn't have them around the house all the time. You had to talk your mom into taking you to the video rental or ride your bike to the video rental store to get your hands on it so you could rewatch it.
When I first bought my first VCR, I think a blank tape. Mm-hmm. Blank 6-hour, you know, videotape, or 2 hours if you did it at standard play, was like $18.
Oh my God. Yeah, probably was. Yeah. SPLP and SLP. I remember it well.
Yes. But, and think about it. That's $1,982.
Right. You could buy a car with that nowadays.
It's crazy when you think about it.
Well, the adaptations have a warm place in my heart. And folks, again, in the comments, let me know some of the adaptations you grew up with. I would love to know, because it's just, I don't know, it's just happy. It just makes me happy to think about these things. So the Raiders one especially, you know, I love that thing so much. All right, well, folks, you've waited long enough. Paul and I have been all over the board with this conversation. Let's get into Battlestar Galactica, the comic book adaptation. Very briefly here, you know, the original pilot was a movie called Saga of the Star World. It was released in two different ways. You had a theatrical film that came out in July of 1978, ran about 125 minutes. That's what Paul and I talked about on Is It Jaws? You can hear a full discussion on that. It was released in several countries before it ever made its way to the United States. Then in September of 1978, it comes to television, right? It comes to ABC. They ran it as one long movie. It was 148 minutes, so a little bit longer than the movie. But then later on, they broke that first pilot up into three episodes. So it became basically the first three episodes of the TV series. When you watch it in reruns, the first three episodes were originally one big package. That's kind of what the pilot Marvel Comics was working on when they did their own ongoing series. But this adaptation we're going to cover covers the theatrical film. And this is and I didn't realize all of this till I started doing research on this one, Paul, but you could buy this thing in three different ways from Marvel. That's how much Marvel was in the game, right? Because if you've heard the story, you know, in late 1970s, Marvel was struggling, right? They were in financial dire straits, and they got the rights to publish something called Star Wars, and they went ahead and did did it and they made a fortune. That has been said. I want to say it's Jim Shooter. I'm talking off the top of my head, so forgive me if I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure Jim Shooter has said Star Wars saved Marvel. It made them so much money. It kept them afloat to make the course corrections they needed to make to keep it going. So at that point, Marvel then was grabbing every license they could and getting it out there as far and wide as they could. So when it came to Battlestar Galactica a year later, they published it as a magazine, the really nice, super glossy Marvel super special magazines they did. That came out right in time with the TV series. So you know, you watch the TV series, you can go to the store and buy the magazine at the same time. They also published this Treasury Edition, which is the larger, the tabloid format. Of course, we have a whole podcast on our network called Treasury Cast, all about that. And this Treasury was published by both Marvel Comics and Whitman. And then they started releasing the standard monthly comic book, which is where they took what we're going to cover and broke it up across a couple issues. And then they kept going on, as I said, to issue 23. Interestingly enough, the comic lasted longer than the TV show. How funny is it that when that happens, like, you know, Micronauts, for example, far outlived the toys, you know, things like that.
I just wish they could bring it all back. I wish they could put the Micronauts into the MCU.
I don't mean to show my hand, but we are going to have an episode about the Micronauts here on Once Upon a Geek. Me and a special guest are already plotting it out. I can't make any promises when it's going to air, but we are going to talk about Micronauts because I love Bill Mantlow, Michael Golden, Pat Broderick, Micronauts. So good. So stinking good.
Oh, yeah. And I will be listening.
So Paul and I, as we discussed, we're going to be talking about the magazine version. It's a little more accessible. I've got a copy here in my hand. Thank you, Clinton Robinson, who gifted this to me. And so we'll be talking about the magazine, but it's essentially the same as the Treasury. This is sort of interesting, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but guys, I spent way too many hours researching this because I found it fascinating. The magazine version and the Treasury version are essentially the exact same thing. Inside, it's the same comic book. It's the same articles. It's the same pinups. It's everything. It's all identical. But then there's weird little changes. Like the Treasury edition and the magazine edition, the cover is essentially the same image of the Galactica and Vipers, except they're done by completely different artists. The one in the Treasury edition is kind of traditional pencil and ink line work, and it's drawn by Rick Bryant. But then they hired Bob Larkin to paint the same image, beautifully, gorgeously rendered for the magazine. So I'm not sure what the philosophy was to have the two different renditions between the magazine and tabloid. I don't know if it was maybe the coloring process or what, but they're distinctly different. We'll come back to that in a second. I do want to talk about it. Just to point out the other differences are like the inside covers were black and white in the Treasury, color in the magazine. And then the other big thing is the interior colors. And this is where the magazine really shines. The colors on the Treasury edition, they're pretty traditional comic book colors. They're kind of, you know, flat, basically, in colors in comparison to the magazine. Whereas the magazine, it looks almost like fully painted watercolor. It's really, really stunning.
Yeah, that really lifts the art in some points where I'm not totally thrilled with the drawn image. It's like the coloring accentuates and makes it better.
Yeah. I'm going to post a couple images on social media. So go out on like Twitter, look for Once Upon a Geek, BSG, around this time in April. You'll see some of these images just so you can get an idea what I'm talking about, the differences. Because, yeah, the coloring in this is absolutely stunning. I do want to talk about the differences in the covers real quick. Yeah, you can see those there, Paul. I'm astounded at the difference that they took the time to basically do the same image by two completely different artists. How bizarre is that?
That is strange. And I got to tell you, we met Bob Larkin at Eternal Con a few years back. What a nice guy.
Oh, wow. Really?
And some of his, I mean, his work is gorgeous. He is a very, very talented artist. And while I think this is an extremely well-rendered painting that he'd made, mm-hmm. I do not like the layout of this. I don't see where this is attracting the audience you want it to attract. It almost looks like it's like the layout of the cover. Now, it's a widespread cover, like, you know, the back page is kind of a continuation of the front page. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the cover itself, it almost looks like it's one of those technical manuals.
Huh. Okay.
I don't see, if I wasn't a fan of Battlestar Galactica, I don't see myself seeing this on the newsstand and saying, I need to pick this up.
Wow. Okay. See, I had a completely different reaction. Now, I'm also total nostalgia goggles on, in that I grew up with the Treasury. So this is like comparing the Treasury edition, which again, is just kind of simple pencil and ink drawing versus the magazine. I feel like I'm going from watching something like an old VCR recording to watching something in 4K is what I feel like I'm doing between these two images. So maybe that's why I'm so biased, is that it's taking something I've known my whole life and just taking it up a notch to being gorgeous. So what the image we're talking about is, it's the Galactica. It's going at sort of a northwesterly northerly direction across the cover, you know, and there's a couple of Vipers flying around, and there's a lot of Cylon Raiders and a lot of explosions. So for me, I found this exciting in that, you know, oh, I love Star Wars. I love spaceships blowing things up, and this would attract me as a kid. Maybe I'm wrong, you know, with your more seasoned eye. Maybe this is like, it's just a ship in space. What's the appeal?
Or maybe I'm just an old crotchety fool.
I mean, there's a lot of that going on. Let's not deny that. That's for sure. But that may not have anything to do with this cover.
You know, like I said, I look at it and I just think, I don't think this is going to pull in somebody. Although, you know, who knows? Maybe the idea was more like, oh, if you see a spaceship, you're going to buy it. You're going to think it's Star Wars.
Well, I was going to say, what would sell instead? Would Starbuck and Apollo shooting their laser guns at Cylon warriors? Would that have been more appealing, you think?
I think to me, it would have been.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. For me, I think that the selling point of Battlestar Galactica is the model work, because Star Wars is what was on everyone's brain. I mean, you mentioned this on Is It Jaws, that Battlestar Galactica was to tide you over in between Star Wars movies. I mean, that was, ABC knew what they were doing. They were like, okay, we're building off the popularity of Star Wars. So the direct connection is the model work, because it's the same model effects people who worked on Star Wars working on BSG. And so to me, that is the selling point. Is the model work. So I don't know, I guess it's two different perspectives. One of us is right, one of us wrong, and I'm driving the ship. So we'll see.
Or maybe we're both right and just talking about different people's different views on it.
There we go. Okay. So talking about the inside here, folks, I'm just going to make a big assumption here that you guys know the general plot of Battlestar Galactica. I mean, I'll give it to you like at a super elevator pitch, high level here. You know, humans at war with the Cylons for over 1,000 years. The Cylons trick the humans into believing they're interested in peace. A surprise massacre of the humans by the Cylons. I mean, they wipe out 12 entire planets of human beings. We're talking billions and billions of humans wiped out, almost their entire Starfleet's wiped out. The only one left is this giant warship called the Battlestar Galactica. And the Galactica flees, running for their lives, and they're shepherding this ragtag fleet of civilian starships. And they're on the run from the Cylons, desperately searching for this story out of myth, this mythical story they all heard of, this 13th colony of man, a planet called Earth. So that's the elevator pitch for Battlestar Galactica. So when you get inside this magazine, we've got this gorgeous cover painted by Bob Larkin, which is absolutely the best possible cover ever. And anyone else who thinks otherwise is wrong. Then you get I love how you just let me breeze right past that. Thank you. Then you get
I don't know who you'd be talking about.
You get the comic book adaptation, which we're going to dig into in a second. But you also get a lot of pinups and you get some articles. So why don't we take a second to just talk about the pinups and the articles, just kind of clear the decks for that, and then we can get into the story. So, I mean, they got some big names in here. You know, the inside cover is a full painted image of a Cylon by Dave Cockrum. Whoa! I mean, what do you think of that?
Yeah, really nice. The only thing about it, and this is the same thing I said on Is It Yours, is the way it's drawn, it looks like a human in battle armor instead of a robot.
Well, you know, I started thinking about this since we had that talk a week ago. You know, nowhere in the pilot do they, unless I'm mistaken, do they specifically say that the Cylons are robots?
You know, I don't think they do. I think
so. We're assuming
so there could be humans in there,
or some kind of humanoid. You know, something. You know, whatever. It could be a creature driving it. You know, whatever. But at no point do they actually say this. So, because I do seem to recall at some point there was a theory that there was a living being inside the armor. But I mean, the fact that it's chrome and it's got a red light and it talks like a robot makes you think it's a robot. But either way, you know, you could argue one way or another. But yes, Paul is really hung up on the fact that the Cylons are a man in a costume. You got to get over that, man. They just look so badass.
it's definitely a badass thing. And, you know, we talked about the reboot. I love the way they made them more robotic, mm-hmm. but they still kept the roving red eye.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then, you know, they are rarely seen in the reboot because, you know, they've been able to mutate to human form. It gets very sophisticated on all of that. But I really did appreciate the new look in the reboot series.
Yeah, I do love how they incorporated the red eye, like in the first scene. Trisha Helfer plays Six and there's a big sex scene and whatever, but you actually see the red line go up and down her spine, which was a really nice, clever way to incorporate the Cylon red beam thing into the visuals. I like that. That's in the reboot, of course. But so Dave Cockrum drawing an amazing Cylon. I mean, your love of the character design, or, you know, set that aside, and Dave Cockrum's rendering is stunning. I mean, that's a way to draw a man in a silver, you know, chrome vacuum chrome costume, make it look dynamic. I think it looks really
good. And I'm a big Cockrum fan. I loved him on the X-Men. I loved him on Legion of Superheroes. I really thought his art was great. It's almost like he became overshadowed by John Byrne taking over on the X-Men. But
you look at the
stuff that he was doing right from the start, and it's outstanding.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And then if you jump forward, he did another one all the way on page 32. He did there's these insect creatures on the planet Carillon, which was like the casino planet. I call them the Carillon crickets, but he did one of those, and it looks fantastic. I mean, it looks even better than it did on the screen. It looks a great insectoid alien. The webbing around his chest, you know, like clothes. It just looks fantastic. And again, Dave Cockrum, what a pro. What a pro. Yeah,
that is, you know, absolutely. Well, it's not beautiful because it's an ugly looking alien, but it's a beautifully beautiful drawing of an ugly looking alien.
There you go. Now, I got to give a couple shout outs to a couple other pinups. There's a lot in here. I don't want to necessarily go through all of them, but there's a couple of folks that are associated closely with my beloved Justice League International book. You know, I do a podcast called Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast, and two of the reoccurring inkers on various Justice League books that era are Joe Rubenstein and Bruce Patterson. And both of them have beautiful pinups in this magazine. Page 21 has a Bruce Patterson painting and is a Cylon radar and the Carillon cricket. So it's the Cylon ship and those cricket creatures. And I'm looking at this going, wait a minute, this guy's an inker and he can do this gorgeous work? This is unbelievable.
I suspect with many inkers like that, it's not a matter of lack of ability to draw what you'd want to see. It's probably more along the lines of this probably took him forever to draw.
It could be. It could be. It is very much like a technical manual, like you said, like the drawing of the Cylon Raider. I mean, there's a lot of intricate detail on there. This could be used as like a technical guide to how to draw the Raider, because there's a lot of detail on it. And I'm here for it, man. Let me tell you. One thing I forgot to even mention, my brother had the model kits for the Viper and the Cylon Warrior ship. And we used to have those around the house. So just seeing this brings back so many memories. Oh my gosh. And then over on page 24, Joe Rubenstein did a beautiful paint. It's I don't know, maybe it's charcoal. I'm not really sure. But again, I'll post some of these on social media on Once Upon a Geek Twitter so you can see them. But it's a beautiful rendering of Starbuck. And there's like a small inset shot of him and Apollo. And then they've got their, it's essentially what in the reboot they called the Dreidus. But I guess it's like radar, essentially, here in the old Battlestar Galactica. Beautiful drawing on there. It's all in reds and oranges and stuff like that. Beautiful.
It's very moody looking.
It is. It really is.
You know, I think these pinups are the bane of the existence of anybody looking for back issues, because some kid who picked this up when they were like 10 might have torn out this picture to hang it up in their room, and now you find it in a back issue bin and you think, oh, I finally found this, and then you realize that page was ripped out.
Well, the next one, definitely, because it's the center page. So there is a center poster that you could pull out. You could pull the staples out and pull it out. It is by Howard Bender, and it is stunning. It's a huge two-page image of Adama with his hand reached out, and then there's all kinds of inset images from the movie. You've got Serena, you've got Boomer, you've got the scary cells where they were taking the humans for food. You got Cylons and the Council of 12 and Muffet, and just all these different characters. But the coloring is gorgeous. I'm not an artist. My brain doesn't work like this. Like when I have to use a coloring book, I color someone's skin color. That's all I do. I don't do anything interesting. And you look at this and the choices they made, and the reds and the yellows rather than flesh color and the bright whites. I mean, wow, is this stunning. Absolutely blows me away.
It almost has that pop art feel about it.
It does. Yeah. I totally see that. And, I do wonder, because I'm with the tabloid edition, I do get the sense that they didn't have as many coloring options. I do wonder what these look like colored in the tabloid edition. I can't find images online. I can't find my copy of it. So I don't know. If anyone's got a tabloid edition, I'd love for you to snap a couple of pictures of the Treasury edition and put it out there, because I'm curious what these pinups look like under more traditional coloring. So there's lots of other ones in here. You got Muffet. You got some alien women. Supposedly there's some John Romita Jr. in here somewhere. He's credited. I don't know where. I can't figure it out. But there's a lot of other interesting fun pinups in here. Any favorites? Like anyone, any of the pinups that, you know, obviously not the Cylon because you don't like the costume, but any other pinups that you're like, you know, that's my favorite.
I think the Cockrum Cricket.
Oh yeah.
I think okay. That is my favorite.
All right. For me, it's the 2-page center spread with Adama that by Howard Bender. I just, wow. I would have hung that up on my wall as a kid without a doubt. All right. So the articles, we're only going to touch on these briefly, but there are some articles in here because the idea is they're selling this to kids, right? Who want to get more out of it than just the story. So there's a great interview in here with John Dykstra, who is, again, famously known for Star Wars photography effects. And here he's working on Battlestar Galactica as the supervisor of special photographic effects. He's also a producer of the thing. Did you get a chance to read the interview? I don't mean to put you on the spot there.
Yeah, I read that interview and I thought it was fascinating to read, you know, like his transition to being a producer and basically kind of feeling like he was too involved.
Right. Yeah.
That nobody wanted to hear what he had to say anymore because he was trying to solve every single problem. But I found it pretty interesting to read.
Yeah. It's almost like he was a little too honest, you know, like just saying like I stuck my nose where I shouldn't have, which is sort of interesting because like at different times he's sort of humble. And then other times he's not cocky or anything because, I mean, he's got the cred. I mean, he made the most talked about movie of 1977, Star Wars. And it's down, you know, a lot of it's down to his effects. So he's talking from authority in that level. But then there's other times, yeah, where he's just kind of knocking himself for what he did with Battlestar Galactica, which is funny.
But, you know, it almost sounded to me like, you know, when they say when you go on an interview and they ask you, you know, what's your biggest weakness? Mm. And you know, you're supposed to answer, well, I just care too much.
Okay.
That's the feel I got from this is, you know, yeah, I'm going to take some blame, but the reason I'm taking this blame is because I really, really wanted this to come out good.
That's fair. Well, you also get some fun photos of the guys working on the model. Like you see people interacting with the Battlestar Galactica model, which is really cool. You see the scale of it. I mean, it's a huge model. It's really, really big. So that was a fun article. It's funny for me because here we sit, you know, 40 years later, John Dykstra, obviously a legend, right? The ILM legend. That's not where my brain goes. My brain goes to his daughter, who is a modern day popular actress, Chloe Dykstra. She's a model. She's an actress. She's a gaming guru. She's an icon and a YouTube channel star, gorgeous redhead. I've seen her on social media for years before I even knew who her dad was. I knew who she was. So for me, I see that name and that's all I can think about is his daughter, who's, you know, I don't want to say equally as famous, but she's very well known nowadays. So that's pretty cool. Mm. There's also articles in here that are, again, really geared for the fan to get a bigger sense of the universe. You get an article called Life in the Future, one on battle tactics, one about spaceships and the hardware of the future, and one on alien robots, all written by Tom Rogers. All these articles. I'm not trying to be dismissive. The articles are fine. They're absolutely fine. It's exactly probably what I would want as a kid to learn more about the Battlestar Galactic universe. I just felt like, I don't know, maybe they were a little too long. Like they could have shortened a couple of them and then give us, I don't know, something else, you know, maybe more of a character profile or an interview with an actor or there we go. How about a profile on Muffet? I know you would have loved that.
You know what I always enjoy when they do when they reveal it is when they give you kind of the character Bible.
Mm, yeah, there you go.
Like, you know, what this is the background of the character that you never saw on the show, but this is what Dirk Benedict knew his history was as he was playing the part, you know, that kind of thing.
I think that's a great, rather than 2 pages of why Vipers are a cool spaceship, you know, maybe half a page on a Viper and instead give us, like you said, you know, a bio on Boomer and Starbuck and Apollo and Adama and Baltar, you know, and things like that. That would have probably been something I think that would appeal to me more. But either way, I don't mean to be dismissive of them. They're fine. I kept thinking of all the stuff I wish I'd had. Oh, hey, look, there's a painting of a Daggett for you. Oh, look at that. All right.
Yeah, I saw that. You know, it's not that I really have a problem with the concept of having a cute little animal on there. But on the show, it just, you know, it just screamed out of little person in a costume.
Yeah, it does.
It was almost like, well, if you can't do it just a little bit more realistic looking, maybe you shouldn't do it.
And I've already forgotten whether we talked about the Daggett on Is It Jaws or on Once Upon a Geek. So if we talked about it on Is It Jaws, I'm sorry, folks. basically the essential is Paul and I both have an issue with the Daggett. Like, I love it from a nostalgic point of view, but at no point when I was a kid did I have any interest in it. It was targeted at me and I did not love it.
Pretty much.
Well, let's talk about the comics. All right. The comic book adaptation. So it is, I'll read you the credits real quick. Script by Roger McKenzie, art and colors by Ernie Colon, letters by John Novick. Editor is Richard Marshall with a different kind of spelling. Associate editor Ralph Macchio and editor-in-chief Jim Shooter. Now, they say Ernie Colon did the colors. I know he obviously did for the magazine. I wonder if he did them for the tabloid or Treasury edition as well. I'm not sure because, again, the colors are strikingly different. But let's get into this. So, like, what did you – we're not going to go beat by beat. We just did that with the movie. We've given you the big picture. Like, what did you love about the comic adaptation? What's the first thing that comes to mind?
Well, the thing I felt most strongly about after I went through it was the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of really striking images in here. There's some that I'm just not happy with at all. Mm-hmm. I hate to focus on the negative, especially on this particular show, but I'm just going to go page 12 in the center. Starbuck almost looks like they thought, you know what, you know, 30, 40 years from now, we're going to cast Katie Sackett in the role. Let's make Starbuck look like her.
You know? That panel's always sat uncomfortably with me because it just doesn't look right. It doesn't look anything like Starbuck. The way they drew it, you're right. It has a feminine quality to it. You're like, is that a man or a woman? I'm not sure.
But just go to the right and look at that. And that almost looks like Neil Adams on Green Lantern and Green Arrow.
Mm.
I mean, and the coloring there is gorgeous. The red highlights and everything is just beautiful. I always have somewhat of an issue on licensed properties. And often it's because the characters don't look like the actors who portray them. And very often in this one, they don't. And often it's because they look too much like them because somebody photoboxed the actual still photos from the movie. I had to get by the fact that a lot of the characters don't look like the actors. And I'm assuming that they probably either didn't have the rights to use their actual images, or Ernie Colon was told, well, this is the actor doing it, but you're not going to see any of the footage beforehand, so you could just guess at what they look like when they're acting in this particular part.
If I can, let me jump off of that, because I think to some extent you're right. I think looking through, I doubt they had the rights to Lauren Green, because Adama has a look of an elder statesman, but doesn't look like Lauren Green. But then other characters do, like Athena, she looks dead on. And there's other characters.
Apollo looks, especially on page 20.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that looks like, okay, we're drawing Richard Hatch here.
It does. So it's sort of interesting. As I go through it, I feel like the artist, Ernie Colon, had some still photos to work from. I think he did. And again, I think he probably didn't have the rights to Lauren Green's likeness, because otherwise I think he would have been closer. But I feel like he had the stills, but maybe they didn't tell him what order they fell in. Because like in the beginning, it should be a fleet of battle stars in space. Because that's how the movie starts. It's a bunch of battle stars. But instead, what we get is the Battlestar Galactica with a fleet of civilian ships from the end of the movie. But that's what we're seeing as the first panel. Then later on, like the Council of 12, the original Council of 12 are meeting. But one of the actors here, you and I talked about this gentleman during the episode, Wilfred Hyde White. His likeness is perfect. I mean, that is absolutely him on page 5 in the bottom left-hand panel. That is him, except he's not in this scene. He's later in the movie. So it's sort of like, I think he had the likeness, he had a photo, but he didn't necessarily know what scene it was from. Same sort of thing happened with Colonel Ty a lot. Like Colonel Ty, clearly he's been told he's an African-American actor, but he's drawing him just like Boomer. He's drawing him in Boomer's costume all the time. So I don't know that he knew who Colonel Ty was either. So again, I think he had some reference, but maybe it wasn't all explained to him what it all represented.
Yeah. I think that's a common thing because they're actually doing production on the film at the same time that these people are being asked to draw the adaptation.
Exactly.
Because you got to think, you know, this is not something you could draw in, you know, a month.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to take time to put this together, you know, especially if you're doing the penciling, the inking, and the coloring.
Mm-hmm. So here's something that this might blow your mind, because I didn't realize till I sat down and counted. So first off, they're adapting a 125-minute movie, all right? So it's a little over 2 hours. They're adapting a two-hour movie, and they did it in 31 pages of comics. I was shocked to figure out the comic was only 31 pages long. I had to go back and physically count pages. I'm like, wait a minute, what? Because with all the articles and the pinups, it buffers it up to some 56 or whatever it is. But the comic itself is only 31 pages. So they had very little room to tell a massive story. And I think it's a credit to Ernie Colon that he pulls it, him and Roger McKenzie, they pull it off. But I got to ask, like, if you had not seen the movie and read this comic, do you think you would get it?
I think so. I think so. I think they did a pretty good job of getting the spirit of the movie into this.
Okay.
You know, you're always going to have to eliminate some. And if you look, you know, if you just page through it quickly, mm-hmm. you could see it's fairly dialogue heavy.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot there to exposit, to get us through the scenes, to give us, you know, the background that we need to get us there. But I think that's a real challenge. And I think for the most part, Mackenzie did well with it. And I mentioned in Is It Yours? And I'm going to talk about it now. The only thing that I didn't care for is the Cylons talk like regular people.
Hmm. Okay.
Do not let the human scum escape. The colonial fleet must not be alerted to our presence here until we are ready to strike. That does not sound like a Cylon to me.
Right. Human scum is really the tipping point for me on that one, because he's putting opinion in there.
Yeah. You know, the Cylons are cold and uncaring and unfeeling. And, you know, you don't want emotion in there at all.
I totally see that. Yeah, I would agree.
You know, I think I would have gone. If you go through this, there is, I think, almost none. There is a little bit, but virtually no narration panels.
Oh.
And I think it might have helped if they had added a couple in and eliminated some of the dialogue. But that's really a nitpick, because I do think he did a good job of bringing the story along as he went through it.
I'll freely admit that we're probably nitpicking more than we should, because for me, I love this. So when I nitpick, it's just things I've noticed. It's harder to notice stuff and just go, I love this page. It's great. There's nothing interesting to say there, folks. So it's easier to talk about stuff that jumped out at us. And one of the things about the massive amount of dialogue in here, and Ernie Colon trying to draw this amazing thing and fit it in 31 pages, is I did find sometimes that the layouts, especially the word balloons, made it challenging to figure out what order to read them in. Like, there were times where I'd be reading a page and I'd go, oh, I just read those word balloons out of order. Oh, I see. I'm supposed to follow it this way. And I think it's because there's so much dialogue that, and it didn't happen all the time. It was just on a few pages here and there, but it was enough that I noticed it and like, huh, okay, that kind of took me out of it for a minute.
I could see how that could happen, but then there were parts where I was kind of like impressed with the way they do it. And I'm going to try and call your attention to page 14, where we have the top dialogue boxes. Then we go to the second row. And at the end of the second row, the dialogue actually goes diagonally down to bring us and continue the, you know, the flow of the artwork with the story. And I thought that was very creative to have the actual dialogue boxes at a diagonal.
Yeah, you get the Z. You very much get that Z effect. You start on the left, you move to your right, you go down diagonally to your left and then to your right. Yeah, that one works expertly. It really does.
And I know, you know, a lot of people really love, you know, just the standard 9-panel grid and going with that. But I kind of love when they break that, mm-hmm. you know, when they kind of get creative with how you're going to lay out the page. And we've talked a lot of times on Back to the Bins, how we kind of enjoy when one panel bleeds over into another. And there's a lot of that going on here. You know, I'm just going to say page 17 at the bottom where the buildings are kind of crashing. Mm-hmm. The top of the building is actually imposing on the panel above it. And then the sides are actually going to, well, actually the sides, yeah, they're going to the next panel.
Yep. And I want to talk about the page for a second, just a compliment to the art here. I feel like that Ernie Colon has actually done a more effective job with his art conveying the destruction of the planet Caprica and the horrific stuff that happened there. I feel like they actually conveyed that better in the comic than they did on the screen. Because in the screen, they're restricted by budget. You know, they can show a close-up of an explosion, and then they can show a map painting in the distance, but they can't necessarily, like that scene, like you said, where that building's collapsing and Serena and Boxy are running to get out of the way, they can't do that, you know, on screen with that budget. So here they can. So I actually feel like the comic is more effective in showing the damage to Caprica. So I really, that's a nod to them, to the creative team here.
The other thing about the artwork that kind of jumps out at me is there's points in it, and I mean this as a compliment, where it almost feels like it's the pencils, and then he gave only the absolute minimum of the inking because he knew what he was going to do with the colors, and he didn't want to over ink it and then end up kind of costing himself in what effect he could create with the colors. And I think that shows great foresight as he was drawing these pages.
Page 20 is a great example of that. You get the center section there. First of all, actually, page 20 is an amazing example all the way around. Like the top half, you get the people of Caprica. They're angry. They're rioting, if you will. And the way he chose to do the colors there, you know, he's not not coloring them how they look. He's coloring them by the way the light is reflecting off their bodies, you know, yellows and oranges, and it's just gorgeous. But then you go to the next panel, which is the, like what you're talking about. You got Apollo in the center, fully inked, fully colored. Behind him, I'm pretty sure those are just pencils. I don't think those are even inked. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. Maybe it's a form of gray pen inking, but it looks like it's just pencils. And then he's just got like a watercolor wash over it, and it's super effective.
Yeah, I totally agree. And then the bottom is fully inked very clearly with the space shot and, you know, all the black, the deep black that it's got going there. You know, really extremely striking the way the artwork is put together in this.
And we talked about the coloring before. Oh my gosh, it's just gorgeous. It's just gorgeous.
And there's a handful of images that I don't like, but they're so outweighed by the ones that I do.
All right, so let's talk about a few of those. Not, we don't want to overdo it, but there's certain things that sort of drive me crazy.
Like I don't care for the bottom right panel on page 19.
Really? I thought 19 was a great looking page.
Yeah, I'm not crazy about that one.
Is this the one where Apollo's standing there and the people are coming at him outraged?
No, the left panel, not the right.
Adama's face?
Yeah, I don't like Adama's face.
You're so broken. That's an absolutely beautiful panel. I love everything with Adama on the, like, I was even thinking about the blue color.
Maybe it's because it just doesn't look lawn green enough to me.
Well, okay. Yeah, I that's fair. And again, I think we've got an issue here where they don't have his rights. I got to suspect, again, because he's probably the biggest name star in the thing at this point. The things that jump out at me, it's funny, I'm cheerleading the coloring, but then I got to point out that in the first half of the book, they colored Apollo blonde. And then switch to brunette. So like, oops, you know, it can happen. They're in a hurry. You know, they got a lot going on here. I don't have a lot of negative things to say. I got a bunch of positive stuff to say.
Like I said, there's a handful of images that I looked at and thought, I don't know. But they're so outweighed by the ones that I like.
Yeah. Like page 11, there's this great circular panel of a Cylon. And he's yelling, fire all cannons. The human must not reach the fleet. And his arm is breaking the panel border. It's got foreshortening. I mean, is it 100% accurate? You know, the way, probably not, but it looks dynamic. It looks exciting. And the Cylon armor is very difficult to make look dynamic in a still shot, because it looks cool when it's moving because all the chrome and the reflection and the light. But when you do a still shot of it, it's hard to make it dynamic. So here it works really, really well, I think.
And is that Apollo above him?
It is.
And by contrast, you're seeing that dynamic arm, which I don't know if the perspective is exactly right on it,
right?
But it definitely, you know, conveys an image of confidence and aggressiveness. And then the image of Apollo is almost like close to panic and trying to control himself.
Mm-hmm.
So the contrast, like within, I don't know, half an inch of each other, is dramatic.
Yeah.
Of course, Adama only has one eye below him, though.
Well, actually, I think what's happening is I think he's got one eye closed and he's crying because he just found out.
He's clearly crying. You could see on the eye that actually exists, you could see the little teardrop. But on the left eye, or the right eye rather, apparently he did a Peter Falk.
Let the man grieve. Let the man grieve. Other stuff that I think they did better, like, for example, page 41, where they kill Baltar. Because here's one of the differences, by the way, between the original movie and the comic versus what ended up being the ongoing TV series. In the original movie and the comic, they kill Baltar. He dies, whereas they refilmed it for the ongoing series. But so Baltar's death here is really gruesome. Like, I feel like they even did a more effective job here in the comic than they did in the movie. Because here you see the Cylon warrior there, like, you know, with blood dripping from the sword. He's, you know, we thank you for your help, Baltar, but your time is at an end, as he's standing over his corpse. You know, that's pretty gruesome. And I think that's pretty pretty well done, even better than it was in the movie.
Now, could that adaptation look less like John Calicos?
Right. Yeah, that's another thing. So clearly, either he didn't have likenesses allowed to use the likeness of that actor, or he didn't know what he looked like. And he just decided to make him bald. So I think it's striking, though, to make Baltar bald. It's kind of a looks cool as a villain. But yeah, it looks absolutely nothing like the actor at all.
I don't care for it. It's one of the ones I don't care for. The very, very first image where he's walking towards the reader.
Okay. All right. Well, I can see that. Yeah.
It's one of the very few.
Yeah, but that's fair.
But the image is that the page where they actually kill him,
mm-hmm.
that art is very dynamic. And that art is like, it's striking. The violence without, you know, I mean, the only gore is that there's the red coloring for the blood. And even that's kind of muted. But with, you know, without showing goriness, just the impact of the killing is severe.
Yeah, it's expertly done, because again, it's more terrifying than the on-screen one, because it happens so quickly in the show. They grab Baltar by the hair, they pull his neck back, and then it's over. They just cut away. Here you see the dead corpse, like, ooh, gosh. Oh, you know, a credit, by the way, to McKenzie. I feel like also one of the things they did better in the comic adaptation in the writing is in the end of the movie, the planet Carillon, where the casino is, it explodes. And I don't feel like they really explained it in the movie. It just kind of happens. And they kind of touch on it for a little bit. But in the comic, I felt like they did a better job of the in the dialogue, making sure the reader understood that basically the planet Carillon is it's just a giant bomb. Like it's got so much of this particular mineral or energy inside the planet that one stray blast could blow up the whole planet. And I got that from reading the comic. I did not get that from the movie. So again, credit to the team here on the comic for doing that.
Now I do like the comic look of the Cylon leader.
Okay.
Very alien looking, kind of threatening looking.
Mm-hmm.
And in both the movie and this, at the point when he says the bargain was altered, don't you think the next line should be pray I don't alter it further?
It's exactly what went through my mind. But we're 2 years in advance of Empire Strikes Back. So yeah, credit to them for doing it.
Maybe this is where Lucas got the idea.
It could be. It could. What do you think your sire Yuri on page 42?
Oh, yeah. I actually kind of like the way he's drawn here. I mean, I loved him in the movie, and I kind of like him here, and it's two totally different looking characters. This is more of a kind of Uncle Festa slash King Kong Bundy.
Okay. it's a definitely a cartoonish version interpretation of that character. But I think it works because, again, he's the slimy politician guy. It works well. And I could go on and name a million panels, guys. If you don't have it in front of you, we're probably just, you know, you're just going, okay, I get it. It's pretty. But it really is beautiful. Again, I'll post a bunch on social media just so you can see how striking this thing is. And the choices he made with how to color or what to ink and what not to ink and the lighting, the characters who dynamic poses, good light. Likenesses, beautiful women, handsome men. I mean, I feel like it's a real win. To be in the most critical thing of it for me is it's the breakneck pace, you know, just like the movie is. I mean, you don't get a chance to catch your breath and you don't get to really absorb the weight of what's happening. You know, again, 31 pages, you know, but there's instances where in the movie, there was a great scene where Lauren Green's character Adama announces that they're going to look for Earth, and they built it up and they built it up and they built it up until he finally says Earth. And you're like, oh, wow. And it kind of had a nice dramatic moment. Well, here you get that moment. You get a nice shot of Adama, but then because it's so crammed, the last two panels on the page go into the next act entirely. So it's like page 37 goes from an important point to okay, onto the next scene. So it almost gets it needs a little more room to breathe.
Yeah, well, they didn't have room in this book to breathe.
Oh, they didn't.
They didn't, and there was no way they were going to work that in.
And there's like a whole thing in the movie. There's like a whole kind of interesting, scary scene where the Viper pilots have to go into this gas cloud, and like it's super hot, and they can't see what they're doing. They have to blow up all these space mines to hopefully navigate the ship through there. It takes, I don't know, it's maybe 10 minute scene. They got two panels, you know, because they got to move it along. They got to get to the end. They skip the whole ending where the Cylon base star, like one of the big plot points in the movie is they destroy the Cylon base star, the bad guys. That whole thing skipped in here too. Again, 31 pages.
Well, you gotta pick and choose. Yeah. What you're going to put in something like this. One of the things that I think that they did was, and we talk about this often, I think that, you know, when you're doing a comic book, there is no budget. You can do whatever you want. And I think the cricket creatures look awesome in this.
Oh, the illustrations of them? Yeah.
Yeah.
Ernie Colon is great at drawing creatures. He really is. And so he did a nice job with it. They're creepy. They're scary. You see the alien queen. You think about this guy, what he had to draw for this. You know, in addition to the amazing coloring, he had to draw human beings. He had to draw really cool aliens. He had to draw cool robots. And he had to draw cool spaceships. That's a big demand on any singular talent, you know, to be able to do that. And he pulled it off.
And that's what I was saying. This is not something you could have just done in a short period of time.
Yeah.
And again, he took on the full load, penciling, inking, and coloring.
Yeah.
It's amazing he didn't do the lettering.
A couple differences that you may not have noticed. And I admit, I went looking on the internet to help me find the differences. A couple things that jumped out that I didn't pick up when I read it. So when we did Is It Jaws, we had a nice conversation about Sire Yuri, the politician guy, and how slimy he was. But some of the points he made, and you even drew comparisons to the Salt Talks, where he wanted to surrender and saying that we could live under the rule of the enemy and be fine. They actually changed that in the comic. In this story, he doesn't say anything about surrendering to the Cylons. He instead thinks they can hide from the Cylons. So a major plot point that we talked about in the film, they just completely flipped it and changed it. So that was kind of shocking when I realized that.
In many ways, I think that seems less naive.
Yeah, it does. It does.
Because it has more of a feel of a real plan. Mm-hmm. Whereas we're going to just put things down and hope that they don't kill us seems, you know, overly optimistic.
Right. Yeah. Surrender to our enemy and we'll be fine. They'll leave us alone. No, they're not. Yeah. And then another thing, and I'm ashamed I didn't even pick up on this. Jane Seymour was in the movie and they have her in the comic. Her name's completely different. I didn't even pick up on that. In the comic, her name is Lyra. And in the movie, her name's Serena. Completely different. And
I didn't pick up on that either.
Yeah. And here in the comic, there's a scene where she sees a doctor and tells her that she's dying of radiation sickness, which is not in the movie at all. Now, that does get carried on to the TV series, but that wasn't in there at all. So for me, you know, I read this Treasury over and over and over as a kid. And so like some of those differences confused the crap out of me. Like Baltar being bald was very confusing to me. Baltar dying in the comic book, I just couldn't understand, you know, as a 6, 7, 8 year old kid, why Baltar's bald and dead, and in the show he's alive and got hair. And like I was trying to rationalize they were two different people with the same name. I mean, I couldn't put it together apparently.
I could see it 6 years old.
I didn't have Wikipedia to explain it to me.
Exactly.
And then Rick Springfield, who's in the movie, they did change him around a little bit too, where is in the movie, he's like begging to go on that opening mission with Apollo, right? The mission that gets him killed, sadly. Well, here in the comic, he's already on the mission, and it's actually Apollo that wants to tag along with him. So they did flip it. I think it works better in the movie because he begged to go on the mission that got himself killed.
Well, yeah, and that creates all sorts of emotion to, you know, and guilt for Apollo.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, yeah, that's a much better touch. But again, you know, maybe it's just kind of, we got to move this thing along. We can't go through the scenes of having him to beg to go.
So you said you think someone could follow this without having seen the movie. I don't know. I'm on the fence. I think someone would struggle. I think they would enjoy this, but I'm not sure that they would pick up all the salient points because what was a 5-minute scene in the movie is one panel in this thing. I feel like they would, I don't know if they'd be able to really experience it fully. I don't know. I'd love to know what people at home thought. Overall, you said you had your experience with adaptations is spotty, you know, hit and miss. What would you say now that you've read this one? What would you say about this one?
Having sat down and read this, I don't know, an hour and a half after I watched the movie, I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun to kind of go through and see some of the scenes. And I enjoyed where it was done a little differently. And I enjoyed sometimes where it was done exactly the same, you know, because it was real easy to compare because of the timing. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know when this came out in relation to when the pilot aired.
Almost the same time as it aired in America in September.
It would almost be cool as a kid to have a copy of this in hand a month before the show aired. Which they would never, ever do. Never. Because they wouldn't want to, you know, they wouldn't want spoilers. But it would be cool. I think they did that actually, now that I'm saying it, I think they did that with Empire Strikes Back. I think there was like a release issue where it came out actually like a week before the movie opened.
Certain things like that happen. Scott Reifen and I talked about one time the novelization of V, which included V and V the Final Battle, actually came out before V the Final Battle aired. So you could actually read the book before you watch the movie.
I don't think that was intentional. I think when they it was that somebody screwed up. But it, like I said, I think it would be fun to be a kid and have this in hand while the show is on and be able to do kind of what I did and, you know, watch the show and then pick up the comic and read it right away. I do think somebody would at least get the, you know, the overall feel of this, you know, and what's going on, even if they hadn't seen the pilot. I'm just not 100% sure why somebody who wasn't watching the show or hadn't seen the pilot would be interested in picking it up, frankly, other than it's, again, it's your Star Wars fix.
Yeah. Or, you know, maybe you missed the pilot because it aired and you missed it that night. And, you know, essentially something's gone from the universe if you missed it. And so this is your chance. Like maybe you watch episode 6 of the TV show, but you go back and read this to get the origins. Maybe. Yeah.
No, I could see that where you've become, I don't know, hooked, but you're somewhat enamored with the TV show and you say, oh, let me see how it began.
Yeah.
Or but I think your biggest audience on this is I watched the pilot. I liked the pilot and VHS doesn't exist yet. So I want to buy this.
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. And I got to tell you, I mean, regardless of the opinion of whether it works or not for somebody who's read, the package is just stunning. It's gorgeous. I mean, I could read anything with this kind of coloring, with this kind of art any day. I'd be thrilled to. It's just that such a beautiful collection. So if you get a chance to pick up Marvel Super Special number 8, the magazine, highly, highly recommend it. At least I do. Paul, I don't know. Would you endorse that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No question. Ignore the layout of the cover and buy it.
Oh, my gosh, the cover's so good. All right. Now, Paul, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging around here for a bit and keep an eye on Starbuck and the four-eyed ladies? I don't really trust him around them, or frankly, I don't trust him around alcohol or playing cards or anything.
Yeah, as long as they'll sing to entertain me.
I just feel better if someone's here keeping an eye on him. So, yeah, perfect. So if you'll hang out and make sure that he can behave himself, I would sincerely appreciate that.
Done.
And don't worry, Paul, we will bring you back at the end of the show. And after this podcast promo break, I am going to read your listener feedback from the last five episodes of Once Upon a Geek.
By your command.
In 1975, Jaws was released. It is routinely regarded as one of the greatest films of all time, and is generally credited with creating the concept of the summer blockbuster. In 1978, in an obvious cash grab, Jaws 2 was released, failing to have lightning strike a second time, but presenting a generally enjoyable film. In 1983, Jaws 3D was released, shamelessly attempting to take advantage of a gullible audience. By 1987, there was no pretense of quality as Lorraine Gary and Michael Caine cashed paychecks for sleepwalking through a pointless and incredulous sequel. In 2016, Paul Spiteri created Is It Jaws, in which he and a group of rotating guest hosts discuss new and old movies and place them up against the Jaws scale, which ignores some elements of the actual films and sets forth a rating scale. Jaws, an all-time great classic film. Jaws 2, an enjoyable film with some flaws but worthy of multiple viewings. Jaws 3, a moderately enjoyable film. And finally, Jaws 4, a bad movie. Please join Paul and his guests as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
By your command.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment. You are about to see.
Because you demanded it. It's Treasury Cast, a podcast devoted to the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. DC, Marvel, Archie, IDW, and more, bigger than life. It's the Treasury Cast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on fireandwaterpodcast.com.
By your command.
And now, your feedback from the past few episodes of Once Upon a Geek. Now, as we get into your feedback, please remember, if you haven't listened to the first half of this conversation over on Is It Jaws Yet, head out over there, listen to Paul and myself talk about the Battlestar Galactica theatrical release. It's a fun conversation. It leads directly into the one you just heard. I should mention, in that conversation Paul and I just had, where we talked a lot about the Marvel comic for Battlestar Galactica, if you go to the show notes for this episode, you'll see a hyperlink that goes to my Twitter account where all of my Battlestar Galactica posts on Twitter for the comic, specifically that tie into this episode, there's a link, you can click it. It'll take you directly to all of those posts, so you can see a lot of the pages that we talked about right there at your fingertips. Then, also, over on Treasury Cast, in this same month, listen to Rob Kelly and I talk about the first couple Star Wars Treasuries, which adapted A New Hope in comic book form, which is always fun to talk about Marvel Star Wars comics. All right, as part of the feedback, I do have a request for you. If you would, please consider leaving us a review over on iTunes, because, you know, while shows on the network have lots and lots of iTunes reviews, this is still a fairly new show. So we could really use the boost, and it would really help raise the profile of the show and attract some new listeners. And as a thank you, we will read your entire iTunes review on the air during our feedback segment, just like this one, from Professor Alan Quarterman of the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network. He says, "Excellently geeky! Shag does an irredeemably fine job of taking a positive and joyous look at all things nerdtastic. TV, movies, comics, books, sci-fi. If it's a geeky subject, he'll cover it. And he and his guests will do a good job when they do cover it." Oh, well, thank you, Professor Allen. That's incredibly kind of you to say so. All right, now we're going to be getting into your comments. Remember, on Once Upon a Geek, we cover your comments from our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. We're going to be covering your feedback from the five most recent episodes. So there are two episodes on Doctor Who. There's an episode where I recorded with my daughter, an episode on Alpha Flight, and an episode on What If. Now, what I've done is I've collected all of the comments from the website and put it together into Google Doc for myself to review, and it is 32 pages long. I kid you not, 32 pages. It is crazy because y'all are an amazing group of people. So what I do for this is I go through the entire Google document myself, and I pick out bits and pieces to read on the air that I think might be interesting for everyone to hear. But I do recommend you go out to our website and read all these comments for yourself because they're absolutely fantastic. So I do want to say, if I've missed anyone's comments on our website, I do sincerely apologize. Drop me a line and let me know. All right, first up, we're going to tackle the Doctor Who technical manual from 1983 that I did an episode on with Dr. Chris Lewis, and also the Doctor Who 2023 Gallifrey 1 convention I recorded with David Ace Gutierrez. All right, up first is my buddy Alan W. Wright, who does the Robin Hood website, boldoutlaw.com. He's also part of the Blake 7 podcast, Straight Out of the Federation. Alan says, I also still have my copy of the technical manual from 1983 or perhaps 1984. I remember that most of the Doctor Who books were easily available in regular bookstores in Canada, in malls and such, and I remember the Target novelizations in my school library. Oh, that is amazing. In your school library? I am so jealous. Not the case here in the States. Then Alan says, I got into Doctor Who during the big 1983 anniversary year, not specifically because of the 20th celebration, but because I finally gave into my friend's pleas to give what, well, what seemed like, as Shag put it, an amateur college knockoff of Star Wars a chance. He says, we only received three regular channels half decently on our little TV set, CTV, CBC, and TV Ontario. He says, TV Ontario is kind of like our PBS, although the pledge drives were less frequent, less tacky, and less entertaining. He goes on to address some of the questions we posed in the episode, so he says his first episode was Armageddon Factor Episode 5. And he says, oddly enough, the Armageddon Factor also played a role in me finding both the Fire and Water Podcast Network and doing a Blake 7 podcast. Look at that, Alan. It all comes back to Tom Baker. Amazing. Then he says, like Dr. Chris Lewis, I have a nostalgic love of Destiny of the Daleks, too. And it would have been likely the first full Doctor Who story I saw. That's fantastic. And there's so much nostalgia for different Doctor Who episodes. Regardless of the quality, we love what we love. Then Alan goes on to say, Doctor Who fandom was odd back in the 1980s. The books were plentiful. Everyone knew what the show was, but we were sort of like second-class geeks for loving it. I joined the local branch of DWIN, which was Canada's Doctor Who Club. We'd watch blurry episodes taped by someone pointing a US video camera at a UK TV months or years before the episodes turned up on PBS or TVO. You know, Alan, that brings up an interesting idea. The whole idea of what we called screeners, right, back in the day, which is where we watched old Doctor Who episodes. Again, like you said, someone literally pointed a video camera at TV. I wonder if that happened in other fandoms. You know, like, I don't know. Red Dwarf? I have no idea. I wonder what other fandoms where people would watch shows from other countries where they had, you know, just done a makeshift recording studio of their own so they could record it. Interesting thought. All right, then we heard from Stephen Kohler, who is one of my only Doctor Who friends growing up. So a lot of the stuff I referenced in that episode, I was talking about stuff that Steve and I did together. So Stephen chimed in a lot of the same questions we covered in the episode. He goes, the best Cybermen design was in Earthshock. And he says, the best episode with Cybermen was The Doctor Falls, because those early Cybermen are indeed really great. Yeah, that Peter Capaldi one, the Cybermen, are amazing, Stephen. He says, best Daleks are the original, and the best episode with them is The Evil of the Daleks. That's a good one. And he says, best other villain is the Ice Warriors. Oh, I do love me some Ice Warriors. He says the best console is William Hartnell's. Ooh, that's a brave statement there, Stephen. But you know what? Everyone loves what they love, so okay. Then he says best companion is Lala Ward as Romana 2. Now he gives a lot of explanations of why in there. Totally valid point. She is a fantastic companion, and Lala Ward did a great job. He says he also carried around a tire gauge that was meant to be a sonic screwdriver. Ah, that's fantastic. Then we heard from Mike Dynas that says, as a recent convert to Doctor Who, it's great to hear all the lore that's been around since the 1960s. Enjoy in both your voices as you talk about some great memories. I don't think I ever saw Doctor Who as a kid, but it must have been in the social consciousness because I kind of knew about it. Then he says the show really passed me by, and it's only in the past couple years that I've tried to search out and watch Doctor Who episodes, and thanks to BritBox, I now can watch almost all of them in order. Right now, at the time of this writing, I'm in the middle of the John Pertwee run, and I'm loving all the episodes I've seen so far. Ah, that's fantastic. And then he says that as far as some of his favorites, he included the Romans, because he likes Ian and Barbara. He said the Crotons, because he had a crush on Zoe. I mean, who didn't, right? And he says the Mind Robber and the War Games. He says the War Chief is fantastically over the top. Oh, those are all good ones, Mike. I'm so glad you liked it. Then Mike chimed in about the Doctor Who convention episode we did, and he says, as a fairly new Who fan, this sounds like a fandom that is fully supportive of each other, which is brilliant. Even though I don't quite get all the references, I'm enjoying just the sheer excitement the both of you have for this convention. Aw, well thanks Mike, I really appreciate all that feedback. Then we heard from James Williams, who says, I have a strange history with Doctor Who. The first time I ever saw Doctor Who were ads in Marvel Comics. I'm guessing they were drawn by the great Dave Gibbons. When I was either in high school or college, our PBS station began showing Doctor Who. They started with the first Peter Davison serial. The Doctor was dead, and then he was alive. He was so confused, and so was I. The Doctor looked different, dressed differently, and didn't have a robot dog. I finished the serial and swore I'd never watch Doctor Who again. Thankfully, a few weeks later, I gave it one more try. I'm guessing that's when I found out the Doctor traveled in time. Well, technically, Colin Baker was my second exposure to the Doctor regenerating. It was the first time I understood what was actually going on. So I'm one of those rare people who love Colin Baker. While PBS was showing Sylvester McCoy's The Doctor, I moved to a different state. My new PBS station didn't show Doctor Who. Little did I realize I would never see Doctor Who again. Right about that time, where Modern Who began, I became ill. My eyes became allergic to light and motion, and I began having excruciating nerve pain. Everyone I knew was watching Doctor Who but me. A few years later, I discovered Big Finish. I couldn't believe that they were producing full cast audio dramas with Peter, Colin, and Sylvester. I've even become a fan of Modern Who characters like River Song, the War Doctor, and Christopher Eccleston's Doctor. Thanks to Big Finish, I'm a bigger Doctor Who fan than ever. Aw, James, that is absolutely wonderful. The Big Finish stuff is excellent, and, you know, I'm so sorry for your condition, but it's wonderful that the Doctor Who, I don't want to say fandom, but the media for Doctor Who is so broad in scope that they're able to produce things that work for you. That's awesome. And thank you so much for sharing, James. Really appreciate it. The word from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz also jumped in and answered a lot of the questions we talked about. For example, Liz says, I do have quite a few action figures now from the show. My favorite version of the TARDIS is, oddly enough, the fifth Doctor one. I miss the circles. I like when they mention them in the 50th anniversary special. And then Liz shared a story of being a child. They said, I did use an old VHS tape to act as the TARDIS. It was a big blue box, so I thought it was close enough. They had the dad from Bionic Six cartoon as an action figure, and the daughter as well, pretending they were the Doctor and Romana too. That is fantastic. I love hearing that story. Then Liz says their favorite companion is Brigadier Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart. That's a great one. Now, Liz gave a defense of why the Brigadier counts as a companion, and Liz, I'm right there with you. Brigadier absolutely counts as a companion. Then Liz goes on to say, I've heard a bunch of the Big Finish stuff. Talks about how much they like Paul McGann. Let's see. Then says, through Big Finish, I'm also getting into the 6th and 7th Doctor, and their favorite monster outside of the Daleks and Cybermen are the Centaurans. Ooh, good choice. Dr. Chris Lewis from the Stormium Arc podcast, of course, the guest on that episode, also says, I wasn't the biggest fan of the 6th Doctor's portrayal at the time, but I love how Big Finish have given him a slightly more mellowed personality. And I'm delighted that all the classic Doctors have had more time in the spotlight due to the audio adventures. I highly recommend them. Oh yeah, Chris, Big Finish is absolutely wonderful. Then we heard from Adam Ackerman, who, by the way, online goes as Centauran, so you can guessing where Adam's going to come out on this. Adam says, I weirdly don't know which Doctor was the first one I saw. The first episode I truly remembered watching and starting from was actually An Unearthly Child. So I basically started watching from the first episode with the first Doctor. Adam says, their favorite? Mine has always been tied between the 3rd and 7th Doctor, and I've never been someone to dislike the 6th Doctor. And then says, for my favorite companions, it would be Ace, then Turlo, then Ace, and then Rory, and then I guess Ace. And as for favorite monster, yeah, wasn't hard to figure out. They picked Centaurans. Then Adam says, for the Cybermen, my favorite episode is Attack of the Cybermen. All right, hold on, Adam. I gotta say, wow, that blows my mind. Because for me, and this, you know, this goes to show that every Doctor Who fan is different, right? But for me, Attack of the Cybermen, it's like unwatchable. I love the Cybermen, but I can't watch that when it's just so confusing and it's just a hot mess for me. But obviously it works for other people. Then Adam says, for the Dalek episodes, was split between Revelation of the Daleks and Remembrance of the Daleks. Okay, see there, we're back on the same page. You know, like, I think Remembrance of the Daleks is one of the greatest episodes of the classic era. And then finally, we talked about Space Freighter from the technical manual, trying to figure out where it was. Adam says the Space Freighter in the book is not actually a Space Freighter. It's a prison ship and was from the 3rd Doctor episode, Frontier in Space. Ah, thank you so much, Adam. In fact, Jack Bond chimes in and says also thank you to Adam. Jack goes on to say, while they were talking, I remembered watching a 3rd Doctor story and being excited to see the Space Freighter, but I couldn't have identified the title. Then Jack says, I hadn't wondered about the patchwork nature of the technical manual. It was very thin for 20 years worth of stuff, but the Who novels were slim too, and that's how they did things. Of course, to ask why the Doctor Who staff would present random, almost disconnected fragments is to suggest that they thought about the fans' mind when they searched the offices for production drawings to work with. This is probably what was accidentally kept when everything else had been thrown away. It could very well be, Jack. It could very well be. They were from Jonathan. That's all they gave us, was just the name Jonathan. Says, my first story I watched, the one that made me an instant fan, was The Power of Krull. My whole family watched this one, and we were at a rented beach house. My memories of that beach house include 10% Clearance Battle Beast, 10% early Excalibur comic book issues, and 80% season 16 and 17 of Doctor Who. That sounds like an awesome beach trip to me. They were from Siskoid from the Firewater Podcast Network. Does shows such as Gimme That Star Trek, Oh Hot More or Not, and a bunch more. Siskoid says, what a great excuse to talk about Doctor Who. And as usual, Dr. Lewis was great. I sincerely believe there are no wrong opinions about what and who to love in Doctor Who, so let me once again defend the giant clam in Genesis of the Daleks, sirs. It's one of the best parts. I like a touch of ridiculousness in my Doctor Who. Well, thank you, Siskoid. Anyway, from David Young, who says, I just listened to your Doctor Who technical manual episode, enjoyed it, even though I've never watched Doctor Who and barely know anything about it. Wow, David. Well, thank you so much. It's very kind of you to say. Considering you're not a fan of the show and that you enjoyed the episode, that speaks volumes. Thank you. Then for Brian Litton, says, perfect timing. I've been doing a rewatch of classic Doctor Who and BritBox, so I was in the perfect headspace for this episode. So then Brian chimes in on a lot of the questions as well. Says, favorite Doctors, the fourth Doctor was the first version of the character that I ever encountered, so he holds a special place in my heart. But the seventh Doctor is probably my favorite. I like that he's more proactive than his predecessors and his long-term plans and strategies. I also like that they hinted at a bit of the Doctor Who's mysterious past in this iteration. Can definitely agree with you on the seventh Doctor stuff. That is some really cool aspects of the character. Favorite companion is Romana 2 because she was more of a peer to the Doctor. Hey, not going to get any arguments with me when you talk nice about Lala Ward. Favorite Dalek episode, Remembrance of the Daleks, because it highlights the reasons why I like the Seventh Doctor, and we get to see the Daleks conquer their greatest enemy, which is stairs. I just said how much I love that episode, so I'm right there with you, Brian. Favorite Cybermen episode, Tomb of the Cybermen. I remember what a big deal it was when this previously lost episode was rediscovered. Oh, yeah, I remember that. It was a very excited moment for all of us in fandom. Favorite other villain, the Valyard. I thought this was a cool character concept, sort of the amalgamation of all the Doctor's darker sides, and they could have done more with it. And they have, actually, on audio, Brian. And then favorite console room, the alternate console room from season 14 of the classic series. I don't know if Victorian is right term to describe the style, but that's the sort of image it conjures in my mind. No, that's an absolutely great one. The wood-paneled TARDIS for Tom Baker was fantastic. Another from DC Dave says, my first ever Doctor Who episode was the Father's Day episode, which was the ninth Doctor story. What a fantastic introduction into the show. I'd heard of Doctor Who, but didn't know anything other than the basics. Self-contained, emotional, time travel, alternate history. It was great and immediately got me hooked. And my favorite Doctor is always a tough question to answer. I love the Eighth Doctor, but depending on my mood, it's usually the second or the third that takes top billing. Depends on which episodes I've recently watched. My favorite Doctor companion mix is definitely the second Doctor and Jamie. There's something about their dynamic that I just absolutely love. Then we're from Mark Baker Wright from the Not Your Father's Autobot podcast and Black Rock's Toy Box. And of course, we hung out with Mark at the Gallifrey 1 convention. Mark says, David Ace Gutierrez mentioned in the Before the Convention segment that he was going to attend a coffee clash, but I don't think he mentioned how it went. I've been to a few over the years, and I've gotten to meet Jason Hay Gallery, Richard Starkings, and David Gerald, among others. The format's pretty informal. It's about a dozen people are in the room with the guest or guests for about an hour, and the conversation goes wherever the people in the room take it. Jason Hay Gallery, for example, asked everyone in the room to introduce themselves and give a brief account of why they were there, and while others just asked if anyone had any questions. I can't speak for how things went with David's particular session, but I hope he was able to have an engaging conversation. The coffee clashes are free to attend, and they typically don't include like the top line guests, but you can nonetheless rub elbows with some influential figures, and I very definitely recommend taking advantage of it. Then Mark goes on to say, there are two aspects of the convention I'd like to highlight that I don't think Shag or David mentioned. The first is the nightly karaoke, which I haven't actually done for a few years myself. Then he says, ask Shag about my attempts to sing Weird Al's eBay. Yes, I was there for that. Then Mark says, but it is karaoke is always a fun diversion. The other is the annual charity auction, in which one can find a variety of sci-fi and pop culture merchandise not available in the dealer's room, and help raise funds for a worthy cause at the same time. This year's charity, the Down Syndrome Association of Los Angeles, which was chosen by Jodie Whittaker herself, and we raised $10,000 as a convention as a whole. Wow, that's awesome, Mark. I'm so glad you mentioned those things. There's so much at the convention that it's almost impossible to remember to mention everything. Now, David Escudero has followed up your question. So he did talk about the coffee clash. He says, it was interesting. And I say that as it was very much about how Lauren, Dodo, Cornelius, and Stephen, the first Dr. Noonan, approached their respective roles. They spoke mainly about the process of acting and how they prepared. And Noonan is a super fan of Doctor Who and would never challenge him in trivia. And Cornelius is just the nicest. Aw. Then we're from Doug Adamson. So thanks for this love letter to the Gallifrey One convention. And it really is a love letter in that your love for the show seeps through every word. It's infectious as well. And I now want to go to the convention. And he says, all too often we hear about conventions which are a nightmare, either too crowded or too noisy or too focused on showing off rather than showing appreciation for the subject matter. Maybe smaller, more focused conventions are what's needed again. And you've sold me on attending and bringing my daughter when she's older. She's only 11 right now. Well, Doug, I can't obviously say enough good things about that convention. We absolutely love it. And then finally, on the Doctor Who convention, we heard from Jimmy McGlinchey. So he's glad to hear you had a great time at Gallifrey 1. Really enjoyed listening to what you and David enjoyed about attending the convention. I had a limited affiliation with Doctor Who. My first Doctor Who episode was The Impossible Astronaut with Matt Smith. I got hooked on it and purchased DVD box sets of Christopher Eccleston and David Tennant's Doctors. I also dived into the Torchwood series at the time. I really enjoyed the series and thought Matt Smith's portrayal was excellent. That's fantastic, Jimmy. Thanks so much for sharing. All right, we're going to move on to another episode of feedback. This time we're going to be talking about the episode entitled Growing Up Geeky, A Teen Girl's Opinion, which is the episode I recorded with my daughter. So special thanks to everyone who left comments on that one, because I love every episode of the show. I do. I really do. But of course, you know, being a parent, I'm extremely proud of my daughter and how awesome she is. So the feedback there was appreciated even more. So, all right, so first up, Siskoid asks, when my daughter's getting her own show on the network? Believe me, she would love that. But I don't think she quite grasped the idea of editing after the conversation. We're from Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog comic box commentary and the Legion of Superbloggers. And Dr. Ange is one of the people that has actually met my daughter. He says, such a great show. And yes, I had the privilege of meeting you two last year, and it was great. I have three Supergirls of my own and made sure I exposed them to all of my nonsense. They have a working education of comics and sci-fi. I also read books to my kids nightly and used different voices. This was especially fun when I read The Hobbit to my second child. I don't know how much of it all stuck. They like the Marvel movies, but so does everyone. But they do all seem to have a love of film, and then I often talk about the technical stuff in films. They talk with me about it, which makes me smile. Oh, that's fantastic, Dr. Ange. Then heard from Captain Entropy, says, great show, Shag and Princess. I have multiple geeky daughters also. I'm not sure how many. They never stand still in the same room long enough for me to count. The objects of their fandom are many and varied, but a character named Taylor Swift is one focus they share. Must be some kind of speedster, I speculate. When this Swift person comes up, and anything can make that happen, it's as if they switch languages. There's also a fashion movement called Harry Styles, which I don't really understand. Regardless, I share enough obsessions with them that there's always common ground for discussion, which I am grateful. Thank you, Captain Entropy. They're from Gene Hendricks, who's the executive director at Azir Voices, and of course, over at Two True Freaks. He says, let me see. My daughter is a Twitch streamer, a YouTube content creator, reads Western and Japanese comics, loves anime, and makes her own cosplay outfits. Yeah, she might just be a little bit geeky. That's awesome, Gene. And I will say, Gene's daughter is awesome. I've met her and hung out with her at a convention. Then we're from Little Russell Burbage from the Legion of Superbloggers, who also has met my daughter. He says, this is just what I needed to hear today. Thank you, Matthews, Darth, and Leia. He brought a tear to my eye, and I'm now going home to wear my Find Your Joy t-shirt tomorrow and try to have a better day. Hope to see you both again soon. And yes, my daughter is also a geek, whose favorite character is Martian Manhunter, and my granddaughter loves Aquaman and all the superheroes. So we're doing something right. Yes, you are. Yes, you are, Little Russell Burbage. Heard from Doug Adamson, who says, my twin 11-year-old girls are also super geeky, and I suspect that's mostly due to their parents. The parallels to Shag's actions are interesting. My wife and I read the girls Harry Potter over the course of 6 years. Then he goes in to talk quite a bit about reading the Harry Potter books and comparing to the films and things like that. And he says, Doctor Who, we powered through during COVID. There are massive arguments in my house about who is the best doctor. And one of my twins is obsessed with the show at the moment and is trying to recruit all of her friends to it. Oh, that's awesome. Then he says, the other twin, who is more into the Hobbits, had me help her build a Lego Elf Rivendell display for one of the Lego shows I run. She's also into Ghostbusters and demanded a Ghostbusters calendar. Oh, that's awesome, Doug. Thank you so much for sharing. Then we heard from Mike Dinos, who says, this was fantastic and brought all the feels. As a parent of two young boys, age 13 and 10, this show brought to mind so many parallels to my own life. He says, it's interesting to see what a geek is today is much different than when I was a kid. Like the princess said, most kids don't really care what you are into these days. You can find someone somewhere that will share your interest, geek or not, which is awesome. Then Mike goes on to say, for myself, I definitely have exposed my kids to all my geeky obsessions, starting with reading superhero board books to them as babies and showing them all my favorite movies now that they're old enough to understand some of the language from the 80s doesn't age well. Boy, that's true, Mike. Adventures in parenting, right? Then heard from Paul Keehan from the Batman Family Reunion podcast. Paul says, this was a wonderful episode. I'm imagining my own sons, aged 28 and 24, and a daughter who's now 20 when they were younger. It brought a tear to my eye, recalling how I read all 11 archive editions of the Justice League to them over the years when they were younger. But my kids never let me do the voices. They said it was too scary. They're all adults now, and each have their own geeky interests, from Lego to D&D to video games to Twitch streaming to comics, of course. But the most touching part of the episode was the discussion about passing on the love of reading in general. That really struck a chord with me. Thanks, Shag, for doing this episode. Aw. Well, thank you, Paul, for listening. Then heard from my buddy Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcast Network. He does shows such as Dark Horse Presents podcast featuring aliens and predators, an Amazing Heroes podcast, and many, many more. Frank says, my partner Paquita was a huge Harry Potter fan as well, especially the Jim Dale audiobooks. See, this is why I like Paquita better than you, Frank. She's brilliant. Anyway, she's a Ravenclaw who identifies as a Slytherin and loves Severus above all. Frank goes on to say, we also did a J.K. Rowling tour in Edinburgh and then a Harry Potter studio tour in London. And that was sort of an exorcism, though, for her fandom, and she's more or less disowns it now. I can understand, but it makes me sad. Then Frank goes on to say, I watched Gilmore Girls sometime into the first season, caught up during initial reruns. Then Frank goes on for this massive paragraph with what I assume is English, talking all about Gilmore Girls and the characters and all the trajectories of the characters. So, hey, you know, Frank, you do you, buddy. All right. Thank you so much. Then we're from Brian Linton, who says, as a fellow father of a geeky teen girl, I really enjoyed this episode and found myself nodding along with so many of what you two said. I just wanted to share a brief exchange that my daughter had with some of her friends, which made me proud. Friend number one says, what's your favorite subject in school? My daughter says, math. Friend number one says, you're such a nerd. Friend number two, and also a fellow proud geek, says, she's wearing a Dungeons & Dragons t-shirt. Of course she's a nerd. Brian says, that's my girl. Also, profound apologies to my wife for turning our daughter to the dark side. Finally, on this episode, Martin Gray from the Two Gingers for a Girl blog says, the Matthews family is so lovely, like the Bradys without Cousin Oliver. I enjoyed hearing young Mrs. M's experience of teen geeks enormously and helped by her natural knack for podcasting. Yeah, she's really good at it, isn't she? That's me as a proud father saying it. Anyway, Martin says, it's great that you, Shag, helped instill a love of reading. It helps you have an intellectually curious child. What a great range of books you enjoyed together. Aw, well, thank you, Martin. I sincerely appreciate it. All right, up next is our discussion about Alpha Flight with my buddy Sean Ross. We had a great time talking about Alpha Flight. Got a lot of comments about Alpha Flight. You guys are definitely fans of the Great White North. So here we go. I heard from Rob McCarthy from the Hell on Wheels webcomic. He had lots of comments. I'll just read a couple here. It says, John Byrne bent the comics code all the way to high heaven, but didn't break it. But there's some weird stuff in there. And then he says, Snowbird is really this, and he gave a link to Nelvana of the Northern Lights. Then I responded talking about the deep connections to Canadian mythology with Nelvana, and Cisco had kind of corrected me, said, well, mythology, I don't know, but Canadian Golden Age comics, yes, and he's written several pieces on Nelvana over on his blog, Cisco's Blog of Geekery. All right. Then heard from J042, and they addressed that second Alpha Flight run we talked about that had been written by Steven Siegel, and Jay says, I gathered from some interviews that Steven Siegel planned on the character of Flex, his origin, having him be a son of Wolverine. Whoa! That would have been mind-blowing, because, yeah, they did hint about his parentage in there, but wouldn't tell us who it was. That's great. Thank you so much, Jay. Then heard from Gord Tolton from the Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast. Gord says, I'd like to see William Shatner play Mac Guardian. Then Marvel can let him write an Alpha Flight comic where he brings himself back to life. Wow, Gordon. That was a huge stretch to make a, Ashes of Eden, I think was the name of the Shatner book where he brought himself, Captain Kirk, back to life. Thank you. I appreciate that, Gord. Then Matt Ev writes in to say, upon listening to Shag and Sean's in-depth examination of the team's history, I realized how very little Alpha Flight I've actually read. Burns run, of course, many, many times, and then a few Mantlo issues, which I really didn't enjoy, and I sort of spotty a couple issues here and there. You made me want to go back and actually check out the full Mantlo run and give it a second shot. It says, Byrne's run is so special to me. I first encountered it as a backup story in the UK reprints of Secret Wars, and also in the Wendigo X-Men story, which was reprinted in the Mighty World of Marvel, both among my earliest and most influential comic experiences. Is it any wonder that the team imprinted on me so hard, or that I was so attached to Byrne's rendition? For one thing, I've always gravitated towards Sasquatch as my favorite Alfin, but to my eyes, no one but Byrne has ever been able to draw him in a way that captures his animalistic physicality. And then Matt says, as I mentioned before, I've always been fond of second stringers being more interesting and compelling than the big stars, and Alpha Flight is second stringers at best. Now, I will say about the second stringers, you're absolutely right. And this network, the Firewater Podcast Network, was founded on Aquaman and Firestorm, so second stringers are in our podcast DNA without a doubt. Also, he talked about the artistic style of Sasquatch and John Byrne being so good at it. Yeah, I mean, Dale Eaglesham wrote an interesting piece when he was doing Alpha Flight saying how hard it was to draw Sasquatch. It was surprisingly difficult to draw all his hair because it's at varying lengths. Very interesting. All right. Then we'll hear from Chris Franklin for the Firewater Podcast Network. He does shows such as JOUcast, House of Frankenstein, and much, much more. He says, I've never read a single issue of Alpha Flight, but I knew enough from Ohotmu and Marvel Saga to follow along. And he points out that, yeah, Marvel Saga had lots of James McDonald in there. The discussion was fun and lively and interesting from a strictly a comic anthropology perspective. A comic title burns brightly for a bit, but then no matter how many times they try, publishers just aren't able to recapture that initial spark. Made even more ironic, considering Byrne didn't want to do that to begin with. Chris, you make a really interesting point. I had forgotten about James McDonald being in Marvel Saga, and I read Marvel Saga religiously as a kid before I ever read Alpha Flight, so that's probably how I learned a lot of the Alpha Flight history was through Marvel Saga. I completely forgot about that. Thank you. And by the way, Chris, I absolutely love that phrase, comic anthropology perspective. That's that's awesome. Or from Siskoid, which is, of course, from Canada. He says that True North Special had a story that took place in Prince Edward Island, which I really enjoyed. But the Maritimes have indeed gotten short shrift. I'm so sorry, Siskoid. If I ever take control of Alpha Flight, I will do my best to represent. There from Liz Ann Oswald, she says, I haven't read much of John Byrne's run on Alpha Flight. Bill Mantlo's run on the book was much more the one I followed. I ended up getting into Alpha Flight, believe it or not, by Ohotmu due to Heather Hudson's file in the book. I ended up picking up issues from there. Then again, regarding that second run of Alpha Flight by Steven Siegel, says, I did enjoy their first few issues where they fought Mesmer, though I wasn't a big fan of Sasquatch becoming almost mindless and then de-aging Guardian. No, I can totally get that, Liz. It was very jarring, but as the series went on, you know, I personally feel like they explained it, and I kind of like that they're doing something different. I mean, we'd seen 130 issues of Alpha Flight as it was, so it's kind of interesting to see something different. Then Liz goes on quite a bit, so it's worth reading her comments out on the website, because as a trans person herself, Liz shares some interesting and lengthy thoughts on this era where Sasquatch and Walter Lankowski were living as Wanda Lankowski. So check out her comments over on our website. Worth your time. And her from Martin Gray again is, good old Alpha Flight. I remember being rather impatient for them to get it together as a team during their first year, even though their individual stories were good. And Martin Gray says, regarding North Star's coming out issue, Sean Ross noted that everything looks clunky from 25 years away. To me, it looked clunky at the time as well. It was just embarrassing to read. I'm sorry to hear that, Martin. Obviously, you come at it from a different perspective than us, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. Thank you. Then Martin says, I was surprised that James McDonald Hudson was so unpopular with our hosts. He was the most handsome man in comics. That hair, those cheekbones, the plaid shirts. And then Martin points out, he goes, so we were on James's case about being 7 years older than Heather. And he says, so that's bad, but there's no mention that Madison Jeffries was probably 25 years older than Heather. That's interesting. And that's probably a fair point. So yeah, that we probably should have mentioned that. All right, then we're from Jason Lady, author of the young adult humorous fantasy adventure novels Monster Problems, Super Problems, and Time Problems. Jason says, my dad and I were huge Marvel guys back in the day, but never picked up Alpha Flight except for the occasional crossover issue. He lists out a lot of the issues he got, including Alpha Flight number 34, Wolverine and Heather Hudson fight Lady Deathstrike and an army of samurai warriors. He says, I love this issue because Heather comes into her own and dubs herself the new Vindicator and just annihilates Lady Deathstrike and her army. Then he says, we also got the Alpha Flight and X-Men two-part miniseries that you guys mentioned, where they face off with Loki. Wonderful story and great artwork by Paul Smith, and Claremont does an excellent job with the Alpha Flight characters. What he did with Puck and Heather and Shaman and Talisman and Northstar in this particular were very memorable to me, and I still have that two-parter and reread it every few years. And he says, I share your opinion that Heather as team leader is 1,000 times more interesting than Mac. I really like the narrative of the civilian wife of the main hero taking up the mantle after his death, making it her own and rising to the occasion as a determined and effective team leader. And then after that, he says, my ideal Alpha Flight lineup, because, you know, that's one of the questions we posed during the episode. He says, is Guardian, Heather Hudson, of course, Northstar, Sasquatch, Puck, Talisman, Persuasion, or Purple Girl, Wildheart, and Diamond Lil. Maybe throw in Windshear and Mannequin too. Oh, no. Jason, don't play to Sean's weird obsession with Mannequin, please. Then finally, he says, my take on a new series for them would be a globe-trotting adventurers working for the UN or even NATO. Canada is a staunch supporter of peacekeeping missions around the world, and Alpha Flight could tackle the super being aspect of that. That's a great idea. That's a good idea on how to get them at a national level, too. Again, heard from my buddy Diablo Frank. He's got quite a lot to say, so I'm just going to read pieces of it. He says, like most of the comic world, I love John Byrne in his prime, and all those great-looking Marvel heroes on the cover of issue number one was an easy sell. However, I soon realized that of all those heroes, Alpha Flight were clearly the least. For instance, grouping Snowbird, Northstar, and Aurora together made it clear that they barely had one costume color between them. Puck's defining character color is his own hairy flesh. The same was true of Marina's jaundiced skin and her actual suit coming out of Namorita's closet. Sasquatch was a poor man's beast, and Shaman seemed rejected by the Global Guardians. I almost couldn't say that with a straight face. Goes on to say, Guardian was the only well-designed character in costume, but that costume was the sum total of his personality. The Alphans fought a bunch of giant muck monsters from Canadian native folklore, which today I would find neat, but as a kid, bored me. Then Frank goes on at great length, and it is fascinating to read. You should, again, go out to our website and read a lot of it about what he says. He even gives some casting for the Alpha Flight characters, like his fan casting of the actors he would cast there. But he says, in summary, I like that Canada has its own weird little super team, sort of like how Kids in the Hall and SCTV are their version of SNL. However, it's a team that's poorly maintained and disrespected within its universe while being maintained by people of not too dubious Canadian lineage. It just makes more sense to get your Maple Comics taste serviced by Chapter House / Lev Gleason, an actual Canadian publisher staffed by residents in the Great North-centric continuity of their own. Well, thank you so much, Frank. I appreciate that. Then heard from our buddy Andrew Leyland. He does shows such as Palace of Glittering Delights, Hey Kids Comics, and many more. He says, I've always had a TV show for Alpha Flight in my head that opened like this. Department H, a clandestine division of the Canadian government, have put together a group of specialized operatives for missions that are too dangerous for the regular military to undertake. If your job's unorthodox, strange, or just downright dangerous, you need to send in Alpha Flight. It seems somewhat familiar. I couldn't place it. Marvel, if you use it, I want 20%. Well, thank you, Andrew. Maybe they could drive a van and go from town to town and build cabbage shooters or something. I don't know. Anyway, then we heard from Tim Price from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast. Tim says, I dropped in and out of Alpha Flight Volume 1, but definitely have a soft spot for this team thanks to Byrne's initial run. Accidentally great comics. Says, now the comparison to the 4th of July is hilarious, but an extra layer to it, there was some letter writer to Batman and the Outsiders back in the day suggested they should introduce a Canadian national superhero team called the Fist of July, since July 1st is Canada's Independence Day, which is to say, that's what Alpha Flight's name would have been if Mike W. Barr had created them. Interesting considering the discussion about the team name. Is Fist of July better or worse than Alpha Flight? I gotta say Alpha Flight's better. That's just my opinion, Tim, but thank you. Then we're from Mike Dynas, who's from Canada. He says, the effrontery of having two Americans covering Canadians' only team and enjoying it to boot, eh? I feel like I need to form a strongly worded passive-aggressive comment, which I will then apologize for after the fact. Thank you, Mike. He says, I loved Alpha Flight from the get-go. After being bombarded with Captain America up here in the Great White North, I was ready to have a Canadian superhero team. And he says, I agree the team became more interesting with Heather as a leader, with her having to deal with the death of Mac, but I enjoy the visual of the original Guardian better. I like the mask more than I like the goggles. I also enjoy that Heather really came into her own after Mac died. She had some great character development over the course of Mantlo's run. I also like how it flips the trope of the side female character dying to propel the main male character story further along. It flips that trope on its head. He says, I'm also a fan of the character of Box. I feel like he was a criminally underused character in the overall Marvel Universe. Yeah, Mike, you're absolutely right. You know, when Box was in the Bill Mantlo era, we had like the garnet and silver look where he could transform and stuff. That was an awesome version of Box and really, really could have done stuff in the Marvel Universe. And I can't believe they didn't use him more. All right, and then finally, Ryan Blake from the Wibbly Wobbly Dicey Wicey Doctor Who podcast says, I want to be a superpower Canadian now. Where do I apply? Well, thank you, Ryan. I think you'd have to get in touch with Siskoid to figure that out. And then the final episode we're going to talk about was the episode we did about What If. So my buddy JT the Exterminator and I, we talked about What If Volume 1, issue number 45, and What If Volume 2, number 9. And we had a great time talking about it, and the response to the What If episode has been fantastic. I do have plans to do more episodes covering issues of What If at some point as well, because it's such a fun thing to do. Anyway, they heard from Brian Schufo. He says, the What If series were usually hit or miss with how the creative team would change dramatically every issue, especially with the first volume. But if you didn't like what you read one issue, you'd probably love the next. And then he says, did anyone else in the 1980s try to fill their collection by reading the letters page to see if you would be interested in what was printed five issues earlier, and then use Mile High Comics ad to see if it was available? I'm pretty sure most of my issues were bought that way. Wow, that is a brilliant strategy, Brian. I did not ever think about that. I love that. I got most of my What If issues from just crawling through 50-cent bins and grabbing anything that looked interesting. However, I do remember, and this wasn't specific to What If, just in general, I do remember flipping through the Overstreet Guide, as they would sometimes give you like a one or two word recap of why an issue was valuable or more important, and that was helpful sometimes trying to figure out what I wanted to seek out. All right, then we're from Rob McCarthy, who says, the stigma with the second series was that it was so 90s. Everything was with the X-Men. I mean, there's a story with Doctor Strange and Dracula where Wolverine becomes Lord of the Vampires. Captain Entropy says, the second volume was definitely not darker than the first. The preference that people have is chronological. The first volume just covered the inflection points that were deeper in the Marvel Universe history, the ones that nerds of our vintage cared about. That wasn't any fault of the second volume's creators. I think you're right there, Captain Entropy. I agree. Siskoid says, exactly. But it's also generally volume one had better art, at least to his taste, had a larger page count, and the inflection points that were more resonant. If you change a hero's origin, that's more interesting than if you change the result of the crossover event of the year. In other words, the first series stole a lot of the better turning points. Both good points, guys. And I would also say, you know, the art on volume two, it was varied, right? It was also very extreme, especially as they went along. And it's true. They did cover more recent events. And as far as I'm concerned, you really can't blame them. You know, they were trying to capitalize on stuff that was already selling, right? And I do understand the criticism of volume two. I truly do. I'm just blinded by it, by my own, you know, nostalgic inertia of it. Ryan Daly chimes in for the Firewater Podcast Network. He does shows such as Cheers Cast, Fire and Water Records. He says that it was a fun discussion, and he liked the sidetrack that we discussion we had into the Marvel Epic Collections. And he says if any listeners are looking to buy some Epic Collections stuff, he is selling his collection of Epic books, so reach out to him. Then we're from Bucky749, goes by American Samurai, has his own YouTube channel. He says, a great episode. And then he says some of his favorite What If comics include What If the Spider Bit Someone Else, What If the Punisher Had Joined S.H.I.E.L.D., and What If Wolverine Was Lord of the Vampires. Awesome. Good stuff, Bucky. Thank you. Chris Franklin chimes in and says, wow, what a fun discussion, gents. The dreaded newsstand distribution monster kept me from getting What If Volume 1, save for two issues. Number 34, which was the all-humor issue, and number 46, the What If Spider-Man's Uncle Ben Had Lived. I love both of these issues for different reasons. I had never seen superheroes lampoon before issue number 34, when it still holds up. Issue number 46 was perfect for me, as I had been really loving the Marvel Tales reprints of the Lee Ditko Spider-Man run, and the Peter Gillis and especially Ron Frenz really captured that early Spider-Man vibe. Then we heard from Liz Ann Oswald, who named some of her favorite issues, including the one where Phoenix Lives was fun. There's a good one where Dr. Doom became Sorcerer Supreme. I definitely enjoyed the issue where Mayday Parker became Spider-Girl. That was great. And then the one where Daredevil kills the Kingpin is pretty good. Those are all great issues, Liz. Absolutely. And that Daredevil one where he kills the Kingpin. Wow, I love that one. I just read that one recently. Then Adam Ackerman chimes in, what if became big enough that Lego had What If Lego sets? So yeah, they are making What If Lego sets now. So, I folks, this is the power of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. We speak pop culture into existence. Then we hear from Andrew Leyland, who says, what if reading was weird in the fairy-laden land of Marvel UK? The strips were largely used as filler material or for the summer-winter specials and the annuals. And as a rule, the important characters got their stories printed, so what if Spider-Man's clone Had Lived got serialized in the weekly Spider-Man comic? And the what if Rick Jones had become the Hulk was printed in the Hulk annual? And what if Uncle Ben Had Lived got the full-color treatment in a Spider-Man winter special? So I have fond memories of that one. And a lot of what if strips saw print in Marvel UK's team-up comic. Then Andy said, worth noting, since this was released, Marvel has announced a What If Omnibus containing the 1988 one-shot and issues 1 through 39 of the late 80s, early 90s series. See? There it is again! Another example of the Fire and Water Podcast Network speaking pop culture into existence. We talk about it, and it becomes a thing. Look at that. Oh, by the way, Andy suggested I should make this show weekly. Whew. Okay, Andy. Slow your roll there, buddy. Then Mike Dynas, last comment here, says, I hardly saw any What If comics growing up due to newsstand distribution. The funny thing is, while I didn't hate What If, all the What If scenarios didn't interest me compared to what happened in the main real title. You know, what if Spider-Man joined the Fantastic Four? I don't care. I like him working alone. What if Captain Marvel hadn't died? Boo. The death of Captain Marvel was one of the most profound comics I read when it came out. Don't undo that amazing story. And so on and so on. But he says, it was really fun to hear the two issues you guys profiled, and they sounded like lots of fun, and I really need to rethink how I felt about What If comics. Ah, Mike, they're so much fun. Again, it's the whole idea is it's, you know, it doesn't counteract with the comics that you read and love. All it does is just enhance them and let you look at them from another light. And really, it's kind of like you get to revisit the story a little bit too. So it's fun. All right, well, that is all the feedback from our website. And I want to say thank you to all of your support for the Once Upon a Geek podcast. You guys are absolutely amazing. Yes, I know the feedback section was very, very long. I'm brainstorming ways to streamline this in the long run. It may be quite a while, but down the line, I think I have an idea on how I can streamline the feedback a little bit. Now, if you'd like to be included in the next feedback section, all you need to do is leave a comment on our website for one of the next few episodes. Again, that's firewaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. And we'll cover the feedback again in another 5 episodes from now. So please keep those cards and letters coming, folks. And my thanks again to all of my co-hosts from the past few episodes. They were absolutely wonderful. And thanks to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break. And when we come back, we'll see if Paul Spataro had any luck wrangling Starbuck and the Four-Eyed Singers from Battlestar Galactica.
By your command.
Where am I?
In the Palace of Glittering Delights.
Who are you?
I am Andrew Leyland, and for over 200 episodes, I have covered everything genre-related, from the obvious things that everyone talks about, Star Trek, to deep dives into the early issues of The Amazing Spider-Man via the obscure, such as ITC's experimental science fiction dramas The Champions or Department S.
It's very cosmopolitan. You never know who you meet next.
In the Palace of Glittering Delights.
Okay, let's get this show on the road, gang.
Available from Two True Freaks and via your podcatcher of choice.
By your command.
Just when you thought it was safe to hear a podcast promo.
Major, do, brave and bold, do, comic books, do, jail may.
JL May, do, brave and the bold, do, comic books, do, JL May.
JL May, do, brave and the bold, do, comic books, do, JL May.
JL May,
JL May. The annual podcast crossover event celebrating the Justice League is back. And we're covering the 2007 Brave and the Bold series that started with Mark Waid and George freaking Perez and ended with J. Michael Straczynski. Throughout the month of May, participating podcasts will release special episodes on issues in the run. It all kicks off in the Overlooked Dark Knight podcast. Follow the event on social media using the hashtag JLMay2023. Coming this May.
JL May, do, brave and the bold, do, comic books, do, Mephisto, hey!
That it? Is that what you want?
Things I do for this show.
By your command.
All right, we're back from break, and we've got Paul back. Paul, thank you so much for appearing on the show.
Yeah, could you please tell this four-eyed girl that I'm married?
That is for you to decide yourself, sir, and whether you want to share that information. But I appreciate you being here to talk about comic book adaptations, to talk about the Battlestar Galactica comic, about the reboot, all of it. Thank you so much, Paul. It's been an absolute joy.
It's always a pleasure. And, you know, I know the way you and I work. So if we try really, really hard, we could probably do this again in another 6 to 8 months.
Yeah, or a year at least, I'm sure. Well, in the meantime, until we can get back together, why don't you tell the folks at home where they can find you?
You can find me on the Two True Freaks Network, which is available on most podcatchers, or at twotruefreaks.com, where I am the co-host of Back to the Bins. I am the host of Is It Yours? And I am the co-host of a series of shows that we've gone through where we're currently, at this point, we're doing an episode-by-episode view of The Prisoner. We're calling it The Village People. previously, we've done Deep Space Nine. We've done a cartoon version of Star Star Trek.
Firefly.
But it's all on the Two True Freaks Network. So look there and you'll find me.
Oh, thank you so much, Paul. Folks, he's got a ton of great shows out there. Any one of them you'll enjoy. Even if you're not an expert or terribly familiar with the subject matter, it's always entertaining. Listen, so thanks again, Paul. I appreciate it.
Thank you, buddy. It's always a pleasure to be here.
All right, folks, we'll come back next time when we cover another topic that brings us joy. And what will that topic be? Well, I'm joining in on the JL May crossover for podcasts. This year, JL May is discussing some of our favorite issues from the Brave and the Bold comic series that ran from 2007 to 2010. So here on Once Upon a Geek, I'll be covering a team-up between Hal Jordan, Green Lantern, and Dr. Fate. Come back next episode to hear that coverage. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
I'm Paul.
And remember, life is short. Focus on the positive.
Find your joy.
Shining planet known as Earth.